Prologue. Dragon Mount. The palace still shook occasionally as the earth rumbled in memory, groaned as if it would deny what had happened. Bars of sunlight cast through rents in the walls, made motes of dust glitter where they hung in the air. Scorch marks marred the walls, the floors, the ceilings. Broad black smears crossed the blistered paints and gilt of once bright murals. Soot overlaying crumbling friezes of men and animals, which seemed to have attempted to walk before the madness grew quiet. The dead lay everywhere. Men and women and children struck down in attempted flight by the lightnings that had flashed down every corridor, or seized by the fires that had stalked them, or sunken into stone of the palace, the stones that had flowed and sought, almost alive, before stillness came again. In odd counterpoint, colorful tapestries and paintings, masterworks all, hung undisturbed, except where bulging walls had pushed them awry. Finely carved furnishings, inlaid with ivory and gold, stood untouched, except where rippling floors had toppled them. The mind-twisting had struck at the core, ignoring peripheral things. Luz Therin Telamon wandered the palace, deftly keeping his balance when the earth heaved.
"Ilyena! My love! Where are you?"
The edge of his pale gray cloak trailed through blood as he stepped across the body of a woman, her golden-haired beauty marred by the horror of her last moments, her still-open eyes frozen in disbelief.
"Where are you, my wife? Where is everyone hiding?"
His eyes caught his own reflection in a mirror, hanging askew from bubbled marble. His clothes had been regal once, in gray and scarlet and gold. Now the finely woven cloth, brought by merchants from across the world sea, was torn and dirty, thick with the same dust that covered his hair and skin. For a moment he fingered the symbol on his cloak. A circle, half white and half black, the colors separated by a sinuous line. It meant something, that symbol, but the embroidered circle could not hold his attention long. He gazed at his own image with as much wonder. A tall man, just into his middle years, handsome once, but now with hair already more white than brown and a face lined by strain and worry, dark eyes that had seen too much. Luz Therin began to chuckle, then threw back his head. His laughter echoed down the lifeless halls.
"Ilyena, my love, come to me, my wife. You must see this."
Behind him, the air rippled, shimmered, solidified into a man who looked around, his mouth twisting briefly with distaste. Not so tall as Luz Therin. He was clothed all in black, save for the snow-white lace at his throat and the silverwork on the turned-down tops of his thigh-high boots. He stepped carefully, handling his cloak fastidiously to avoid brushing the dead. The floor trembled with aftershocks, but his attention was fixed on the man staring into the mirror and laughing.
"Lord of the Morning," he said, "I have come for you."
The laughter cut off as if it had never been, and Luz Therin turned, seeming unsurprised.
"Ah, a guest. Have you the voice, stranger? It will soon be time for the singing, and here all are welcome to take part. Ilyena, my love, we have a guest. Ilyena, where are you?"
The black-clad man's eyes widened, darted to the body of the golden-haired woman, then back to Luz Therin.
"Shaitan, take you. Does the taint already have you so far in its grip?"
"That name, Shai..." Luz Therin shuddered and raised a hand as though to ward off something.
"You mustn't say that name. It is dangerous."
"So you remember that much, at least. Dangerous for you, fool. Not for me. What else do you remember? Remember, you light-blinded idiot? I will not let it end with you swaddled in unawareness. Remember!"
For a moment, Luz Therin stared at his raised hand, fascinated by the patterns of grime. Then he wiped his hand on his even dirtier coat and turned his attention back to the other man.
"Who are you? What do you want?"
The black-clad man drew himself up arrogantly.
"Once I was called Elan Morin Tedronai,
But now...
Betrayer of hope.
It was a whisper from Luz Theron. Memory stirred, but he turned his head, shying away from it.
So you do remember some things. Yes, betrayer of hope. So have men named me, just as they named you Dragon. But unlike you, I embrace the name. They gave me the name to revile me, but I will yet make them kneel and worship it. What will you do with your name? After this day, men will call you Kinslayer. What will you do with that?
Luz Theron frowned down the ruined hall.
Ilyena should be here to offer a guest welcome,
he muttered absently, then raised his voice.
Ilyena, where are you?
The floor shook. The golden-haired woman's body shifted as if in answer to his call. His eyes did not see her. Ilan Morin grimaced.
Look at you, he said scornfully. Once you stood first among the servants. Once you wore the ring of Tamerlan and sat in the high seat. Once you summoned the nine rods of dominion. Now look at you, a pitiful, shattered wretch. But it is not enough. You humbled me in the hall of servants. You defeated me at the gates of Parandizan. But I am the greater now. I will not let you die without knowing that. When you die, your last thought will be the full knowledge of your defeat, of how complete and utter it is, if I let you die at all.
I cannot imagine what is keeping Ilyena. She will give me the rough side of her tongue if she thinks I have been hiding a guest from her. I hope you enjoy conversation, for she surely does. Be forewarned. Ilyena will ask you so many questions, you may end up telling her everything you know.
Tossing back his black cloak, Ilan Morin flexed his hands.
A pity for you, he mused, that one of your sisters is not here. I was never very skilled at healing, and I follow a different power now. But even one of them could only give you a few lucid moments, if you did not destroy her first. What I can do will serve as well for my purposes.
His sudden smile was cruel.
But I fear Shaitan's healing is different from the sort you know. Be healed, Luz Theron!
He extended his hands, and the light dimmed as if a shadow had been laid across the sun. Pain blazed in Luz Theron, and he screamed a scream that came from his depths, a scream he could not stop.
Fire seared his marrow. Acid rushed along his veins.
He toppled backwards, crashing to the marble floor. His head struck the stone and rebounded. His heart pounded, trying to beat its way out of his chest, and every pulse gushed new flame through him. Helplessly he convulsed, thrashing, his skull a sphere of purest agony on the point of bursting. His hoarse screams reverberated through the palace.
Slowly, ever so slowly, the pain receded.
The outflowing seemed to take 1,000 years and left him twitching weakly, sucking breath through a raw throat. Another 1,000 years seemed to pass before he could manage to heave himself over, muscles like jellyfish, and shakily push himself up on hands and knees. His eyes fell on the golden-haired woman, and the scream that was ripped out of him dwarfed every sound he had made before. Tottering, almost falling, he scrabbled brokenly across the floor to her. It took every bit of his strength to pull her up into his arms. His hands shook as he smoothed her hair back from her staring face.
Ilyena! Light, help me! Ilyena!
His body curved around hers protectively, his sobs the full-throated cries of a man who had nothing left to live for.
Ilyena! No! No!
You can have her back, Kinslayer. The great lord of the dark can make her live again, if you will serve him, if you will serve me.
Luz Theron raised his head, and the black-clad man took an involuntary step back from that gaze.
10 years, betrayer,
Luz Theron said softly, the soft sound of steel being bared.
10 years your foul master has racked the world. And now this. I will...
10 years, you pitiful fool. This war has not lasted 10 years, but since the beginning of time. You and I have fought 1,000 battles with the turning of the wheel. 1,000 times 1,000. And we will fight until time dies and the shadow is triumphant.
He finished in a shout with a raised fist, and it was Luz Theron's turn to pull back, breath catching at the glow in the betrayer's eyes. Carefully, Luz Theron laid Ilyena down, fingers gently brushing her hair. Tears blurred his vision as he stood, but his voice was iced iron.
For what else you have done, there can be no forgiveness, betrayer. But for Ilyena's death, I will destroy you beyond anything your master can repair. Prepare to...
Remember, you fool. Remember your futile attack on the great lord of the dark. Remember his counterstroke. Remember. Even now, the 100 companions are tearing the world apart, and every day 100 men more join them. What hand slew Ilyena's son here, Kinslayer? Not mine. Not mine. What hand struck down every life that bore a drop of your blood? Everyone who loved you. Everyone you loved. Not mine, Kinslayer. Not mine. Remember, and know the price of opposing Shaitan.
Sudden sweat made tracks down Luz Theron's face through the dust and dirt. He remembered, a cloudy memory like a dream of a dream, but he knew it true. His howl beat at the walls, the howl of a man who had discovered his soul damned by his own hand, and he clawed at his face as if to tear away the sight of what he had done. Everywhere he looked, his eyes found the dead. Torn they were, or broken, or burned, or half-consumed by stone. Everywhere lay lifeless faces he knew, faces he loved, old servants and friends of his childhood, faithful companions through the long years of battle. And his children, his own sons and daughters, sprawled like broken dolls, play stilled forever, all slain by his hand. His children's faces accused him, blank eyes asking why, and his tears were no answer. The betrayer's laughter flogged him, drowned out his howls. He could not bear the faces, the pain. He could not bear to remain any longer. Desperately he reached out to the true source, to tainted Sidene, and he traveled. The land around him was flat and empty. A river flowed nearby, straight and broad, but he could sense there were no people within 100 leagues. He was alone as a man could be while still alive, yet he could not escape memory. The eyes pursued him through the endless caverns of his mind. He could not hide from them. His children's eyes, Ilyena's eyes. Tears glistened on his cheeks as he turned his face to the sky.
Light, forgive me.
He did not believe it could come, forgiveness. Not for what he had done. But he shouted to the sky anyway, begged for what he could not believe he could receive.
Light, forgive me.
He was still touching Sidene, the male half of the power that drove the universe, that turned the wheel of time, and he could feel the oily taint fouling its surface, the taint of the shadow's counterstroke, the taint that doomed the world. Because of him. Because in his pride he had believed that men could match the Creator, could mend what the Creator had made and they had broken. In his pride he had believed. He drew on the true source deeply, and still more deeply, like a man dying of thirst. Quickly he had drawn more of the one power than he could channel unaided. His skin felt as if it were aflame. Straining, he forced himself to draw more, tried to draw it all.
Light, forgive me, Ilyena!
The air turned to fire, the fire to light liquefied. The bolt that struck from the heavens would have seared and blinded any eye that glimpsed it, even for an instant. From the heavens it came, blazed through Luz Theron Telamon, bored into the bowels of the earth. Stone turned to vapor at its touch. The earth thrashed and quivered like a living thing in agony. Only a heartbeat did the shining bar exist, connecting ground and sky. But even after it vanished, the earth yet heaved like the sea in a storm. Molten rock fountained 500 feet into the air, and the groaning ground rose, thrusting the burning spray ever upward, ever higher. From north and south, from east and west, the wind howled in, snapping trees like twigs, shrieking and blowing as if to aid the growing mountain ever skyward, ever skyward. At last the wind died, the earth stilled to trembling mutters. Of Luz Theron Telamon, no sign remained. Where he had stood, a mountain now rose miles into the sky, molten lava still gushing from its broken peak. The broad, straight river had pushed into a curve away from the mountain, and there it split to form a long island in its midst. The shadow of the mountain almost reached the island. It lay dark across the land like the ominous hand of prophecy. For a time, the dull, protesting rumbles of the earth were the only sound. On the island, the air shimmered and coalesced. The black-clad man stood staring at the fiery mountain rising out of the plain, his face twisted in rage and contempt. "You cannot escape so easily, dragon. It is not done between us. It will not be done until the end of time." Then he was gone, and the mountain and the island stood alone, waiting. And the shadow fell upon the land, and the world was riven stone from stone. The oceans fled, and the mountains were swallowed up, and the nations were scattered to the eight corners of the world. The moon was as blood, and the sun was as ashes. The seas boiled, and the living envied the dead. All was shattered, and all but memory lost, and one memory above all others, of him who brought the shadow and the breaking of the world. And him they named Dragon. From Aleth Nin Terin Alta Camorra, The Breaking of the World. Author unknown, The Fourth Age. And it came to pass in those days, as it had come before and would come again, that the dark lay heavy on the land and weighed down the hearts of men, and the green things failed, and hope died. And men cried out to the Creator, saying, "O light of the heavens, light of the world, let the promised one be born of the mountain, according to the prophecies, as he was in ages past and will be in ages to come. Let the prince of the morning sing to the land that green things will grow and the valleys give forth lambs. Let the arm of the Lord of the dawn shelter us from the dark, and the great sword of justice defend us. Let the dragon ride again on the winds of time." From Charal Drianan Te Kalamon, The Cycle of the Dragon. Author unknown, The Fourth Age. Chapter 1. An Empty Road. The wheel of time turns, and ages come and pass, leaving memories that become legend. Legend fades to myth, and even myth is long forgotten when the age that gave it birth comes again. In one age, called the Third Age by some, an age yet to come, an age long past, a wind rose in the mountains of mist. The wind was not the beginning. There are neither beginnings nor endings to the turning of the wheel of time, but it was a beginning. Born below the ever-cloud-capped peaks that gave the mountains their name, the wind blew east out across the sand hills, once the shore of a great ocean before the breaking of the world. Down it flailed into the two rivers, into the tangled forest called the Westwood, and beat at two men walking with a cart and horse down the rock-strewn track called the Quarry Road. For all that spring should have come a good month since, the wind carried an icy chill as if it would rather bear snow. Gusts plastered Randall Thor's cloak to his back, whipped the earth-colored wool around his legs, then streamed it out behind him. He wished his coat were heavier, or that he had worn an extra shirt. Half the time when he tried to tug the cloak back around him, it caught on the quiver swinging at his hip. Trying to hold the cloak one-handed did not do much good anyway. He had his bow in the other, an arrow nocked and ready to draw. As a particularly strong blast tugged the cloak out of his hand, he glanced at his father over the back of the shaggy brown mare. He felt a little foolish about wanting to reassure himself that Tam was still there. But it was that kind of day. The wind howled when it rose, but aside from that, quiet lay heavy on the land. The soft creak of the axle sounded loud by comparison. No birds sang in the forest, no squirrels chittered from a branch. Not that he expected them, really. Not this spring. Only trees that kept leaf or needle through the winter had any green about them. Snarls of last year's bramble spread brown webs over stone outcrops under the trees. Nettles numbered most among the few weeds. The rest were the sorts with sharp burrs or thorns, or stinkweed, which left a rank smell on the unwary boot that crushed it. Scattered white patches of snow still dotted the ground where tight clumps of trees kept deep shade. Where sunlight did reach, it held neither strength nor warmth. The pale sun sat above the trees to the east, but its light was crisply dark, as if mixed with shadow. It was an awkward morning, made for unpleasant thoughts. Without thinking, he touched the nock of the arrow. It was ready to draw to his cheek in one smooth movement, the way Tam had taught him. Winter had been bad enough on the farms, worse than even the oldest folk remembered, but it must have been harsher still in the mountains if the number of wolves driven down into the two rivers was any guide. Wolves raided the sheep pens and chewed their way into barns to get the cattle and horses. Bears had been after the sheep, too, where a bear had not been seen in years. It was no longer safe to be out after dark. Men were the prey as often as sheep, and the sun did not always have to be down. Tam was taking steady strides on the other side of Bella, using his spear as a walking staff, ignoring the wind that made his brown cloak flap like a banner. Now and again he touched the mare's flank lightly to remind her to keep moving. With his thick chest and broad face, he was a pillar of reality in that morning, like a stone in the middle of a drifting dream. His sun-roughened cheeks might be lined, and his hair have only a sprinkling of black among the gray, but there was a solidness to him, as though a flood could wash around him without uprooting his feet. He stumped down the road, now impassively. Wolves and bears were all very well, his manner said, things that any man who kept sheep must be aware of. But they had best not try to stop Tam el-Thor getting to Emmonsfield. With a guilty start, Rand returned to watching his side of the road, Tam's matter-of-factness reminding him of his task. He was a head taller than his father, taller than anyone else in the district, and had little of Tam in him physically, except perhaps for a breadth of shoulder. Gray eyes and the reddish tinge to his hair came from his mother, so Tam said. She had been an outlander, and Rand remembered little of her aside from a smiling face, though he did put flowers on her grave every year, at Beltane in the spring, and at Sunday in the summer. Two small casks of Tam's apple brandy rested in the lurching cart, and eight larger barrels of apple cider, only slightly hard after a winter's curing. Tam delivered the same every year to the Wine Spring Inn for use during Beltane, and he had declared that it would take more than wolves or a cold wind to stop him this spring. Even so, they had not been to the village for weeks. Not even Tam traveled much these days. But Tam had given his word about the brandy and cider, even if he had waited to make delivery until the day before festival. Keeping his word was important to Tam. Rand was just glad to get away from the farm, almost as glad as about the coming of Beltane. As Rand watched his side of the road, the feeling grew in him that he was being watched. For a while he tried to shrug it off. Nothing moved or made a sound among the trees, except the wind. But the feeling not only persisted, it grew stronger. The hairs on his arms stirred, his skin prickled as if it itched on the inside. He shifted his bow irritably to rub at his arms and told himself to stop letting fancies take him. There was nothing in the woods on his side of the road, and Tam would have spoken if there had been anything on the other. He glanced over his shoulder and blinked. Not more than 20 spans back down the road, a cloaked figure on horseback followed them. Horse and rider alike black, dull, and ungleaming. It was more than habit than anything else that kept him walking backward alongside the cart even while he looked. The rider's cloak covered him to his boot tops. The cowl tugged well forward so no part of him showed. Vaguely, Rand thought there was something odd about the horseman, but it was the shadowed opening of the hood that fascinated him. He could see only the vaguest outlines of a face, but he had the feeling he was looking right into the rider's eyes. And he could not look away. Queasiness settled in his stomach. There was only shadow to see in the hood, but he felt hatred as sharply as if he could see a snarling face, hatred for everything that lived. Hatred for him, most of all, for him above all things. Abruptly a stone caught his heel, and he stumbled, breaking his eyes away from the dark horseman. His bow dropped to the road, and only an outthrust hand grabbing Bella's harness saved him from falling flat on his back. With a startled snort, the mare stopped, twisting her head to see what had caught her. Tam frowned over Bella's back at him. "Are you all right, lad?"
"A rider," Rand said breathlessly, pulling himself upright. "A stranger following us."
"Where?" The older man lifted his broad-bladed spear and peered back warily.
"There, down the—"
Rand's words trailed off as he turned to point. The road behind was empty. Disbelieving, he stared into the forest on both sides of the road. Bare-branched trees offered no hiding place, but there was not a glimmer of horse or horseman. He met his father's questioning gaze.
"He was there. A man in a black cloak, on a black horse."
"I wouldn't doubt your word, lad. But where is he gone?"
"I don't know. But he was there."
He snatched up the fallen bow and arrow, hastily checked the fletching before re-knocking, and half drew before letting the bowstring relax. There was nothing to aim at.
"He was."
Tam shook his grizzled head.
"If you say so, lad. Come on, then. A horse leaves hoof prints even on this ground."
He started toward the rear of the cart, his cloak whipping in the wind.
"If we find them, we'll know for a fact he was there. If not, well, these are days to make a man think he's seeing things."
Abruptly, Rand realized what had been odd about the horseman, aside from his being there at all. The wind that beat at Tam and him had not so much as shifted a fold of that black cloak. His mouth was suddenly dry. He must have imagined it. His father was right. This was a morning to prickle a man's imagination. But he did not believe it. Only, how did he tell his father that the man who had apparently vanished into air wore a cloak the wind did not touch? With a worried frown, he peered into the woods around them. It looked different than it ever had before. Almost since he was old enough to walk, he had run loose in the forest. The ponds and streams of Riverwood, beyond the last farms east of Emmonsfield, were where he had learned to swim. He had explored into the sandhills, which many in the Two Rivers said was bad luck. And once he had even gone to the very foot of the Mountains of Mist, him and his closest friends, Matt Cawthon, and Perrin Ibarra. There was a lot further afield than most people in Emmonsfield ever went. To them, a journey to the next village, up to Watch Hill or down to Devon Ride, was a big event. Nowhere in all of that had he found a place that made him afraid. Today, though, the Westwood was not the place he remembered. A man who could disappear so suddenly could reappear just as suddenly, maybe even right beside them.
"No, Father, there's no need."
When Tam stopped in surprise, Rand covered his flush by tugging at the hood of his cloak.
"You're probably right. No point looking for what isn't there. Not when we can use the time getting on to the village and out of this wind."
"I could do with a pipe," Tam said slowly, "and a mug of ale where it's warm."
Abruptly, he gave a broad grin.
"And I expect you're eager to see Egwene."
Rand managed a weak smile. Of all things he might want to think about right then, the mayor's daughter was far down the list. He did not need any more confusion. For the past year, she had been making him increasingly jittery whenever they were together. Worse, she did not even seem to be aware of it. No, he certainly did not want to add Egwene to his thoughts. He was hoping his father had not noticed he was afraid when Tam said, "Remember the flame, lad, and the void." It was an odd thing Tam had taught him. Concentrate on a single flame and feed all your passions into it, fear, hate, anger, until your mind became empty. "Become one with the void," Tam said, "and you could do anything." Nobody else in Emmonsfield talked that way. But Tam won the archery competition at Beltane every year with his flame and his void. Rand thought he might have a chance of placing this year himself, if he could manage to hold on to the void. For Tam to bring it up now meant he had noticed. But he said nothing more about it. Tam clucked Bella into motion once more, and they resumed their journey, the older man striding along as if nothing untoward had happened, and nothing untoward could. Rand wished he could imitate him. He tried forming the emptiness in his mind, but it kept slipping away into images of the black-cloaked horsemen. He wanted to believe that Tam was right, that the rider had just been his imagination, but he could remember that feeling of hatred too well. There had been someone, and that someone had meant him harm. He did not stop looking back until the high-peaked, thatched roofs of Emmons Field surrounded him. The village lay close onto the westwood, the forest gradually thinning until the last few trees stood actually among the stout frame houses. The land sloped gently down to the east. Though not without patches of woods, farms and hedge-bordered fields and pastures quilted the land beyond the village, all the way to the Riverwood and its tangle of streams and ponds. The land to the west was just as fertile, and the pastures there lush in most years, but only a handful of farms could be found in the Westwood. Even those few dwindled to none miles short of the sandhills, not to mention the mountains of mist, which rose above the Westwood treetops, distant but in plain sight from Emmons Field. Some said the land was too rocky, as if there were not rocks everywhere in the two rivers, and others said it was hard luck land. A few muttered that there was no point getting any closer to the mountains than needs be. Whatever the reasons, only the hardiest men farmed in the Westwood. Small children and dogs dodged around the cart in whooping swarms once it passed the first row of houses. Bella plodded on patiently, ignoring the yelling youngsters who tumbled under her nose playing tag and rolling hoops. In the last months, there had been little of play or laughter from the children. Even when the weather had slackened enough to let children out, fear of wolves kept them in. It seemed the approach of Beltane had taught them how to play again. Festival had affected the adults as well. Broad shutters were thrown back, and in almost every house the goodwife stood in a window, apron tied about her and long braided hair done up in a kerchief, shaking sheets or hanging mattresses over the window sills. Whether or not leaves had appeared on the trees, no woman would let Beltane come before her spring cleaning was done. In every yard, rugs hung from stretched lines, and children, who had not been quick enough to run free in the streets, instead vented their frustration on the carpets with wicker beaters. On roof after roof, the goodman of the house clambered about, checking the thatch to see if the winter's damage meant calling on old Sen Bui, the thatcher. Several times Tam paused to engage one man or another in brief conversation. Since he and Rand had not been off the farm for weeks, everyone wanted to catch up on how things were out that way. Few Westwood men had been in. Tam spoke of damage from winter storms, each one worse than the one before, and stillborn lambs, of brown fields where crops should be sprouting and pastures greening, of ravens flocking in where songbirds had come in years before. Grim talk, with preparations for Beltane going on all around them, and much shaking of heads. It was the same on all sides. Most of the men rolled their shoulders and said, "Well, we'll survive, the light willing." Some grinned and added, "And if the light doesn't will, we'll still survive." That was the way of most Two Rivers people. People who had to watch the hail beat their crops or the wolves take their lambs and start over, no matter how many years it happened, did not give up easily. Most of those who did were long since gone. Tam would not have stopped for Whitconger if the man had not come out into the street, so they had to halt or let Bella run him over. The Congers and the Coplins, the two families were so intermarried no one really knew where one family led off and the other began, were known from Watch Hill to Devon Ride, and maybe as far as Tarran Ferry, as complainers and troublemakers. "I have to get this to Bran Alvear, Whit," Tam said, nodding to the barrels in the cart. But the scrawny man held his ground with a sour expression on his face. He had been sprawled on his front steps, not up on his roof, though the thatch looked as if it badly needed Master Bowie's attention. He never seemed ready to start over or to finish what he started the first time. Most of the Coplins and Congers were like that, those who were not worse.
"What are we going to do about Nynaeve, Althor?" Conger demanded. "We can't have a wisdom like that for Emmons Field."
Tam sighed heavily.
It's not our place, Wit. The wisdom is women's business.
Well, we'd better do something, Althor. She said we'd have a mild winter and a good harvest. Now you ask her what she hears in the wind, and she just scowls at you and stomps off.
If you asked her the way you usually do, Wit, Tam said patiently, you're lucky she didn't thump you with that stick she carries.
Now, if you don't mind, this brandy.
Nynaeve Almira is just too young to be a wisdom, Althor. If the women's circle won't do something, then the village council has to.
What business of yours is the wisdom, Wit Conger?
Roared a woman's voice. Wit flinched as his wife marched out of the house. Daze Conger was twice as wide as Wit, a hard-faced woman without an ounce of fat on her. She glared at him with her fists on her hips.
You try meddling in women's circle business and see how you like eating your own cooking, which you won't do in my kitchen, and washing your own clothes and making your own bed, which won't be under my roof.
But Daze, Wit whined, I was just...
If you'll pardon me, Daze, Tam said.
Wit, the light shine on you both.
He got Bella moving again, leading her around the scrawny fellow. Daze was concentrating on her husband now, but any minute she could realize whom it was Wit had been talking to. That was why they had not accepted any of the invitations to stop for a bite to eat or something hot to drink. When they saw Tam, the goodwives of Emmonsfield went on point like hounds spotting a rabbit. There was not one of them who did not know just the perfect wife for a widower with a good farm, even if it was in the Westwood. Rand stepped along just as quickly as Tam, perhaps even more so. He was sometimes cornered when Tam was not around, with no way to escape outside of rudeness. Herded onto a stool by the kitchen fire, he would be fed pastries or honey cakes or meat pies, and always the goodwife's eyes weighed and measured him as neatly as any merchant's scales and tapes, while she told him that what he was eating was not nearly so good as her widowed sister's cooking or her next-to-eldest cousin's. Tam was certainly not getting any younger, she would say. It was good that he had loved his wife so. It boded well for the next woman in his life. But he had mourned long enough. Tam needed a good woman. It was a simple fact, she would say, or something very close, that a man just could not do without a woman to take care of him and keep him out of trouble. Worst of all were those who paused thoughtfully at about that point, then asked with elaborate casualness exactly how old he was now. Like most Two Rivers folk, Rand had a strong, stubborn streak. Outsiders sometimes said it was the prime trait of people in the Two Rivers that they could give mules lessons and teach stones. The goodwives were fine and kindly women for the most part, but he hated being pushed into anything, and they made him feel as if he were being prodded with sticks. So he walked fast and wished Tam would hurry Bella along. Soon the street opened onto the green, a broad expanse in the middle of the village. Usually covered with thick grass, the green this spring showed only a few fresh patches among the yellowish-brown of dead grass and the black of bare earth. A double handful of geese waddled about, beadily eyeing the ground, but not finding anything worth pecking, and someone had tethered a milk cow to crop the sparse growth. Toward the west end of the green, the wine spring itself gushed out of a low stone outcrop in a flow that never failed. A flow strong enough to knock a man down, and sweet enough to justify its name a dozen times over. From the spring, the rapidly widening wine spring water ran swiftly off to the east, willows dotting its banks all the way to Master Thane's mill and beyond, until it split into dozens of streams in the swampy depths of the Waterwood. Two low, railed footbridges crossed the clear stream at the green, and one bridge wider than the others and stout enough to bear wagons. The wagon bridge, marked where the north road, coming down from Tarin Ferry and Watch Hill, became the old road, leading to Devon Ride. Outsiders sometimes found it funny that the road had one name to the north and another to the south, but that was the way it had always been, as far as anyone in Emmonsfield knew, and that was that. It was a good enough reason for Two Rivers people. On the far side of the bridges, the mounds were already building for the Beltane fires. Three careful stacks of logs, almost as big as houses. They had to be on clear dirt, of course, not on the green, even sparse as it was. What a festival did not take place around the fires would happen on the green. Near the wine spring, a score of older women sang softly as they erected the spring pole. Shorn of its branches, the straight, slender trunk of a fir tree stood 10 feet high, even in the hole they had dug for it. A knot of girls too young to wear their hair braided sat cross-legged and watched enviously, occasionally singing snatches of the song the women sang. Tam clucked at Bella as if to make her speed her pace, though she ignored it, and Rand studiously kept his eyes from what the women were doing. In the morning, the men would pretend to be surprised to find the pole. Then at noon, the unmarried women would dance the pole, entwining it with long colored ribbons while the unmarried men sang. No one knew when the custom began or why, and it was another thing that was the way it had always been. But it was an excuse to sing and dance, and nobody in the Two Rivers needed much excuse for that. The whole day of Beltane would be taken up with singing and dancing and feasting, with time out for foot races and contests and almost everything. Prizes would be given not only in archery, but for the best with the sling and the quarterstaff. There would be contests at solving riddles and puzzles, at the rope tug and lifting and tossing weights. Prizes for the best singer, the best dancer, and the best fiddle player. For the quickest to shear a sheep. Even the best at bowls and at darts. Beltane was supposed to come when spring had well and truly arrived, the first lambs born and the first crop up. Even with the cold hanging on, though, no one had any idea of putting it off. Everyone could use a little singing and dancing, and to top everything, if the rumors could be believed, a grand display of fireworks was planned for the green. If the first peddler of the year appeared in time, of course. That had been causing considerable talk. It was 10 years since the last such display, and that was still talked about. The wine spring inn stood at the east end of the green, hard beside the wagon bridge. The first floor of the inn was river rock, though the foundation was of older stone some said came from the mountains. The whitewashed second story, where Brandelwyn Alvear, the innkeeper and mayor of Emmonsfield for the past 20 years, lived in the back with his wife and daughters, jutted out over the lower floor all the way around. Red roof tile, the only such roof in the village, glittered in the weak sunlight, and smoke drifted from 3 of the inn's dozen tall chimneys. At the south end of the inn, away from the stream, stretched the remains of a much larger stone foundation, once part of the inn, or so it was said. A huge oak grew in the middle of it now, with a bole 30 paces around and spreading branches as thick as a man. In the summer, Brenelvir set tables and benches under those branches, shady with leaves then, where people could enjoy a cup and a cooling breeze while they talked or perhaps set out a board for a game of stones. "Here we are, lad." Tam reached for Bella's harness, but she stopped in front of the inn before his hand touched leather. "Knows the way better than I do," he chuckled. As the last creak of the axle faded, Branalvir appeared from the inn, seeming as always to step too lightly for a man of his girth, nearly double that of anyone else in the village. A smile split his round face, which was topped by a sparse fringe of gray hair. The innkeeper was in his shirt sleeves, despite the chill, with a spotless white apron wrapped around him. A silver medallion in the form of a set of balance scales hung on his chest. The medallion, along with the full-size set of scales used to weigh the coins of the merchants who came down from Bearlawn for wool or tobacco, was the symbol of the mayor's office. Bran only wore it for dealing with the merchants and for festivals, feast days, and weddings. He had it on a day early now, but that night was winter night, the night before Beltane, when everyone would visit back and forth almost the whole night long, exchanging small gifts, having a bite to eat and a touch to drink at every house. After the winter, Rand thought, he probably considers winter night excuse enough not to wait until tomorrow.
"Tam!" the mayor shouted as he hurried toward them. "The lights shine on me. It's good to see you at last. And you, Rand. How are you, my boy?"
"Fine, Master Alvear," Rand said. "And you, sir?" But Bran's attention was already back on Tam.
"I was almost beginning to think you wouldn't be bringing your brandy this year. You've never waited so late before."
"I've no liking for leaving the farm these days, Bran," Tam replied. "Not with the wolves the way they are, and the weather." Bran harumphed.
"I could wish somebody wanted to talk about something besides the weather. Everyone complains about it, and folk who should know better expect me to set it right. I've just spent 20 minutes explaining to Mistress Aldonnell that I can do nothing about the storks. Though what she expected me to do..."
He shook his head.
"An ill omen," a scratchy voice announced. "No storks nesting on the rooftops at Beltane."
Senbui, as gnarled and dark as an old root, marched up to Tam and Bran and leaned on his walking staff,
near as tall as he was and just as gnarled. He tried to fix both men at once with a beady eye.
"There's worse to come, you mark my words."
"Have you become a soothsayer, then, interpreting omens?" Tam asked dryly. "Or do you listen to the wind like a wisdom? There's certainly enough of it, some originating not far from here."
"Mark, if you will,"
Sen muttered.
"But if it doesn't warm enough for crops to sprout soon, more than one root cellar will come up empty before there's a harvest. By next winter, there may be nothing left alive in the two rivers but wolves and ravens. If it is next winter at all, maybe it will still be this winter."
"Now what is that supposed to mean?" Bran said sharply. Sen gave them a sour look.
"I've not much good to say about Nynaeve Elmira. You know that. For one thing, she's too young to—" "No matter. The women's circle seems to object to the village council even talking about their business, though they interfere in ours whenever they want to, which is most of the time, or so it seems to—"
"Sen," Tam broke in, "is there a point to this?"
"This is the point, Althor. Ask the wisdom when the winter will end, and she walks away. Maybe she doesn't want to tell us what she hears on the wind. Maybe what she hears is that the winter won't end. Maybe it's just going to go on being winter until the wheel turns and the age ends. There's your point."
"Maybe sheep will fly," Tam retorted, and Bran threw up his hands.
"The light protect me from fools. You sitting on the village council, Sen. And now you're spreading that Copland talk. Well, you listen to me. We have enough problems without—"
A quick tug at Rand's sleeve and a voice pitched low, for his ear alone, distracted him from the older man's talk.
"Come on, Rand, while they're arguing, before they put you to work."
Rand glanced down and had to grin. Matt Cawthon crouched beside the cart so Tam and Bran and Sen could not see him, his wiry body contorted like a stork trying to bend itself double. Matt's brown eyes twinkled with mischief, as usual.
"Dav and I caught a big old badger, all grouchy at being pulled out of his den. We're going to let it loose on the green and watch the girls run."
Rand's smile broadened. It did not sound as much like fun to him as it would have a year or two back, but Matt never seemed to grow up. He took a quick look at his father. The men had their heads together still, all three talking at once, then lowered his own voice.
"I promised to unload the cider. I can meet you later, though."
Matt rolled his eyes skyward.
"Toting barrels? Burn me. I'd rather play stones with my baby sister."
"Well, I know of better things than a badger.
We have strangers in the Two Rivers. Last evening—"
For an instant, Rand stopped breathing.
"A man on horseback?"
he asked intently.
"A man in a black cloak on a black horse. And his cloak doesn't move in the wind."
Matt swallowed his grin and his voice dropped to an even hoarser whisper.
"You saw him, too? I thought I was the only one. Don't laugh, Rand, but he scared me."
"I'm not laughing. He scared me, too.
I could swear he hated me, that he wanted to kill me."
Rand shivered. Until that day, he had never thought of anyone wanting to kill him, really wanting to kill him. That sort of thing just did not happen in the Two Rivers. A fist fight, maybe, or a wrestling match, but not killing.
"I don't know about hating Rand, but he was scary enough anyway. All he did was sit on his horse looking at me, just outside the village. But I've never been so frightened in my life. Well, I looked away, just for a moment. It wasn't easy, mind you. Then when I looked back, he'd vanished. Blood and ashes. 3 days it's been, and I can hardly stop thinking about him. I keep looking over my shoulder."
Matt attempted a laugh that came out as a croak.
"Funny how being scared takes you. You think strange things. I actually thought, just for a minute, mind, it might be the Dark One."
He tried another laugh, but no sound at all came out this time. Rand took a deep breath. As much to remind himself as for any other reason, he said by rote,
"The Dark One and all of the Forsaken are bound to Sheol Ghul, beyond the Great Blight. Bound by the Creator at the moment of creation, bound until the end of time. The hand of Creator shelters the world, and the light shines on us all."
He drew another breath and went on.
"Besides, if he was free, What would the Shepherd of the Night be doing in the Two Rivers watching farm boys?
I don't know. But I do know that rider was... evil. Don't laugh. I'll take an oath on it. Maybe it was the dragon.
You're just full of cheerful thoughts, aren't you? Rand muttered. You sound worse than Sen.
My mother always said the Forsaken would come for me if I didn't mend my ways.
If I ever saw anybody who looked like Ishamael or Ajinor, it was him.
Everybody's mother scared them with the Forsaken, Rand said dryly, but most grow out of it.
Why not the Shadow Man while you're about it?
Matt glared at him.
I haven't been so scared since... No, I've never been that scared, and I don't mind admitting it.
Me either.
My father thinks I was jumping at shadows under the trees.
Matt nodded glumly and leaned back against the cartwheel.
So does my Da. I told Dav and Elam Dautry. They've been watching like hawks ever since, but they haven't seen anything.
Now Elam thinks I was trying to trick him. Dav thinks he's down from Tarin Ferry, a sheep stealer or a chicken thief.
A chicken thief!
He lapsed into affronted silence.
It's probably all foolishness anyway, Rand said finally. Maybe he is just a sheep stealer.
He tried to picture it, but it was like picturing a wolf taking the cat's place in front of a mouse hole.
Well, I didn't like the way he looked at me. And neither did you. Not if how you jumped at me is any guide.
We ought to tell someone.
We already have, Matt, both of us, and we weren't believed. Can you imagine trying to convince Master Alvir about this fellow without him seeing him? He'd send us off to Nynaeve to see if we were sick.
There are two of us now. Nobody could believe we both imagined it.
Rand rubbed the top of his head briskly, wondering what to say. Matt was something of a byword around the village. Few people had escaped his pranks. Now his name came up whenever a wash line dropped the laundry in the dirt or a loose saddle girth deposited a farmer in the road. Matt did not even have to be anywhere around. His support might be worse than none. After a moment, Rand said, "Your father would believe you put me up to it. And mine?" He looked over the cart to where Tam and Bran and Sen had been talking, and found himself staring his father in the eyes. The mayor was still lecturing Sen, who took it now in sullen silence.
"Good morning, Matrim," Tam said brightly, hefting one of the brandy casks up onto the side of the cart. "I see you've come to help Rand unload the cider. Good lad."
Matt leaped to his feet at the first word and began backing away.
"Good morning to you, Master Althor, and to you, Master Alvir. Master Bowie, may the light shine on you. My Da sent me to..."
"No doubt he did," Tam said. "And no doubt, since you are a lad who does his chores right off, you've finished the task already. Well, the quicker you lads get the cider into Master Alvir's cellar, the quicker you can see the Gleeman."
"Gleeman!"
Matt exclaimed, stopping dead in his footsteps, at the same instant that Rand asked, "When will he get here?" Rand could remember only two Gleemen coming into the Two Rivers in his whole life, and for one of those he had been young enough to sit on Tam's shoulders to watch. To have one there actually during Beltane, with his harp and his flute and his stories and all. Emmonsfield would still be talking about this festival 10 years off, even if there were not any fireworks.
"Foolishness," Sen grumbled, but fell silent at a look from Bran that had all the way to the mayor's office in it.
Tam leaned against the side of the cart, using the brandy cask as a prop for his arm.
"Yes, a gleeman, and already here. According to Master Alvir, he's in a room in the inn right now." "Arrived in the dead of night, he did."
The innkeeper shook his head in disapproval.
"Pounded on the door till he woke the whole family. If not for festival, I'd have told him to stable his own horse and sleep in the stall with it. Gleeman or not. Imagine coming in the dark like that."
Rand stared wonderingly. No one traveled beyond the village by night, not these days, certainly not alone. The thatcher grumbled under his breath again, too low this time for Rand to understand more than a word or two.
"Madman and unnatural."
"He doesn't wear a black cloak, does he?" Matt asked suddenly.
Bran's belly shook with his chuckle.
"Black! His cloak is like every gleeman's cloak I've ever seen. More patches than cloak and more colors than you can think of."
Rand startled himself by laughing out loud, a laugh of pure relief.
The menacing black-clad rider as a gleeman was a ridiculous notion, but... He clapped a hand over his mouth in embarrassment.
"You see, Tam," Bran said, "there's been little enough laughter in this village since winter came. Now even the gleeman's cloak brings a laugh. That alone is worth the expense of bringing him down from Berlon."
"Say what you will," Sen spoke up suddenly. "I still say it's a foolish waste of money. And those fireworks you all insisted on sending off for."
"So there are fireworks," Matt said. But Sen went right on.
"They should have been here a month ago with the first peddler of the year. But there hasn't been a peddler, has there? If he doesn't come by tomorrow, what are we going to do with them? Hold another festival just to set them off? That's if he even brings them, of course."
"Sen," Tam sighed, "you've as much trust as a Tauren ferryman."
"Where is he, then? Tell me that, Althor."
"Why didn't you tell us?" Matt demanded in an aggrieved voice. "The whole village would have had as much fun with the waiting as with the gleeman. Or almost, anyway. You can see how everybody's been over just a rumor of fireworks."
"I can see," Bran replied with a sidelong look at the Thatcher. "And if I knew for sure how that rumor started, if I thought, for instance, that somebody had been complaining about how much things cost where people could hear him when the things are supposed to be secret..." Sen cleared his throat.
"My bones are too old for this wind. If you don't mind, I'll just see if Mistress Alvir won't fix me some mulled wine to take the chill off. Mayor? Althor?"
He was headed for the inn before he finished, and as the door swung shut behind him, Bran sighed.
"Sometimes I think Nynaeve is right about... Well, that's not important now. You young fellas think for a minute. Everyone's excited about the fireworks, true. And that's only at a rumor. Think how they'll be if the peddler doesn't get here in time, after all they're anticipating. And with the weather the way it is, who knows when he will come. They'd be 50 times as excited about a gleeman."
"And feel 50 times as bad if he hadn't come," Rand said slowly. "Even Beltane might not do much for people's spirits after that."
"You have a head on your shoulders when you choose to use it," Bran said. "He'll follow you on the village council one day, Tam, mark my words. He couldn't do much worse right now than someone I could name."
"None of this is unloading the cart," Tam said briskly, handing the first cask of brandy to the mayor.
"I want a warm fire, my pipe, and a mug of your good ale."
He hoisted the second brandy cask onto his shoulder. "I'm sure Rand will thank you for your help. Matrim, remember, the sooner the cider is in the cellar." As Tam and Bran disappeared into the inn, Rand looked at his friend.
"You don't have to help. Dav won't keep that badger long."
"Oh, why not?" Matt said resignedly.
"Like your Da said, the quicker it's in the cellar."
Picking up one of the casks of cider in both arms, he hurried toward the inn in a half trot.
"Maybe Egwene is around. Watching you stare at her like a pole-axed ox will be as good as a badger any day."
Rand paused in the act of putting his bow and quiver in the back of the cart. He really had managed to put Egwene out of his mind. That was unusual in itself. But she would likely be around the inn somewhere. There was not much chance he could avoid her. Of course, it had been weeks since he saw her last.
"Well?"
Matt called from the front of the inn.
"I didn't say I would do it by myself. You aren't on the village council yet."
With a start, Rand took up a cask and followed. Perhaps she would not be there after all. Oddly, that possibility did not make him feel any better. Chapter 2 Strangers. When Rand and Matt carried the first barrels through the common room, Master Alvir was already filling a pair of mugs with his best brown ale, his own make, from one of the casks racked against one wall. Scratch, the inn's yellow cat, crouched atop it with his eyes closed and his tail wrapped around his feet. Tam stood in front of the big fireplace of River Rock, thumbing a long-stemmed pipe full of tobacco from a polished canister the innkeeper always kept in the plain stone mantel. The fireplace stretched half the length of the big square room, with a lintel as high as a man's shoulder, and the crackling blaze of the hearth vanquished the chill outside.
At that time of the busy day before festival, Rand expected to find the common room empty except for Bran and his father and the cat. But four more members of the village council, including Sen, sat in high-backed chairs in front of the fire, mugs in hand and blue-gray pipe smoke wreathing their heads. For once, none of the stones boards were in use, and all of Bran's books stood idle on the shelf opposite the fireplace. The men did not even talk, peering silently into their ale, or tapping pipe stems against their teeth in impatience as they waited for Tam and Bran to join them. Worry was not uncommon for the village council these days, not in Emmons Field, and likely not in Watch Hill or Devon Ride, or even Tarn Ferry, though who knew what Tarn Ferry folk really thought about anything. Only two of the men before the fire, Aral Luhan, the blacksmith, and John Thane, the miller, so much as glanced at the boys as they entered. Master Luhan, though, made it more than a glance. The blacksmith's arms were as big as most men's legs, roped with heavy muscle. And he still wore his long leather apron, as if he had hurried to the meeting straight from the forge. His frown took them both in, then he straightened around in his chair deliberately, turning his attention back to an overstudious tamping of his pipe with a thick thumb. Curious, Rand slowed, then barely bit back a yelp as Matt kicked his ankle. His friend nodded insistently toward the doorway at the back of the common room, and hurried on without waiting. Limping slightly, Rand followed less quickly.
"What was that about?" he demanded as soon as he was in the hall that led to the kitchen. "You almost broke my—"
"It's old Luhan," Matt said, peering past Rand's shoulder into the common room. "I think he suspects I was the one who—"
He cut off abruptly as Mistress Alvear bustled out of the kitchen, the aroma of fresh-baked bread wafting ahead of her. The tray in her hands carried some of the crusty loaves for which she was famous around Emmons Field, as well as plates of pickles and cheese. The food reminded Rand abruptly that he had eaten only an end of bread before leaving the farm that morning. His stomach gave an embarrassing rumble. A slender woman, with a thick braid of graying hair pulled over one shoulder, Mistress Alvear smiled in a motherly fashion that took in both of them.
"There is more of this in the kitchen if you two are hungry, and I never knew boys your age who weren't.
Or any other age, for that matter.
If you prefer, I'm baking honey cakes this morning."
She was one of the few married women in the area who never tried to play matchmaker with Tam. Toward Rand, her motherliness extended to warm smiles and a quick snack whenever he came by the inn, but she did as much for every young man in the area. If she occasionally looked at him as if she wanted to do more, at least she took it no further than looks, for which he was deeply grateful. Without waiting for a reply, she swept on into the common room. Immediately, there was the sound of chairs scraping on the floor as the men got to their feet, and exclaimings over the smell of the bread. She was easily the best cook in Emmons Field, and not a man for miles around but eagerly leaped at a chance to put his feet under her table.
"Honey cakes," Matt said, smacking his lips.
"After," Rand told him firmly, "or we'll never get done." A lamp hung over the cellar stairs just beside the kitchen door, and another made a bright pool in the stone-walled room beneath the inn, banishing all but a little dimness in the furthest corners. Wooden racks along the walls and across the floor held casks of brandy and cider, and larger barrels of ale and wine, some with taps driven in. Many of the wine barrels were marked with chalk in Branalvir's hand, giving the year they had been bought, what peddler had brought them, and in which city they had been made. But all of the ale and brandy was the make of Two Rivers farmers or of Bran himself. Peddlers and even merchants sometimes brought brandy or ale from outside, but it was never as good and cost the earth besides, and nobody ever drank it more than once.
"Now," Rand said, as they set their casks in the racks, "what did you do that you have to avoid Master Luhan?"
Matt shrugged.
"Nothing, really. I told Adan Alkar and some of his snot-nosed friends, Ewan Fingar and Dag Coplin, that some farmers had seen ghost hounds breathing fire and running through the woods. They ate it up like clotted cream."
"And Master Luhan is mad at you for that?" Rand said doubtfully.
"Not exactly."
Matt paused, then shook his head.
"You see, I covered two of his dogs with flour, so they were all white. Then I let them loose near Dag's house. How was I to know they'd run straight home? It really isn't my fault. If Mistress Luhan hadn't left the door open, they couldn't have gotten inside. It isn't like I intended to get flour all over her house."
He gave a bark of laughter.
I hear she chased old Luhan and the dogs, all three, out of the house with a broom.
Rand winced and laughed at the same time.
If I were you, I'd worry more about Alsbet Luhan than about the blacksmith. She's almost as strong and her temper is a lot worse. No matter, though. If you walk fast, maybe he won't notice you.
Matt's expression said he did not think Rand was funny.
When they went back through the common room, though, there was no need for Matt to hurry. The six men had their chairs in a tight knot before the fireplace. With his back to the fire, Tam was speaking in a low voice, and the others were leaning forward to listen. So intent on his words, they would likely not have noticed if a flock of sheep had been driven through. Rand wanted to move closer to hear what they were talking about, but Matt plucked at his sleeve and gave him an agonized look. With a sigh, he followed Matt out to the cart. On their return to the hallway, they found a tray by the top of the steps and hot honey cakes filling the hall with their sweet aroma. There were two mugs as well and a pitcher of steaming mulled cider. Despite his own admonition about waiting until later, Rand found himself making the last two trips between cart and cellar while trying to juggle a cask and a piping honey cake. Setting his final cask in the racks, he wiped crumbs from his mouth while Matt was unburdening himself, then said, "Now for the glee." Feet clattered on the stairs, and Ewan Fingar half fell into the cellar in his haste, his pudgy face shining with eagerness to impart his news.
"There are strangers in the village!"
He caught his breath and gave Matt a wry look.
"I haven't seen any ghost hounds, but I hear somebody flowered Master Luhan's dogs. I hear Mistress Luhan has ideas who to look for, too."
The years separating Rand and Matt from Ewan, only 14, were usually more than enough for them to give short shrift to anything he had to say. This time they exchanged one startled glance, then both were talking at once.
"In the village?" Rand asked. "Not in the woods?"
"Right on top of him," Matt added.
"Was his cloak black? Could you see his face?"
Ewan looked uncertainly from one of them to the other, then spoke quickly when Matt took a threatening step.
"Of course I could see his face. And his cloak is green, or maybe gray. It changes. It seems to fade into wherever he's standing. Sometimes you don't see him, even when you look right at him. Not unless he moves. And hers is blue, like the sky, and 10 times fancier than any feast day clothes I ever saw. She's 10 times prettier than anybody I ever saw, too. She's a high-born lady, like in the stories. She must be."
"Her?" Rand said.
"Who are you talking about?"
He started at Matt, who had put both hands on the top of his head and squeezed his eyes shut.
"They're the ones I meant to tell you about," Matt muttered, "before you got me off onto—"
He cut off, opening his eyes for a sharp glance at Ewan.
"They arrived last evening," Matt went on after a moment, "and took rooms here at the inn. I saw them ride in. Their horses, Rand. I never saw horses so tall or so sleek. They look like they could run forever." "I think he works for her." "In service," Ewan broke in. "They call it being in service in the stories."
Matt continued as if Ewan had not spoken.
"Anyway, he defers to her, does what she says. Only he isn't like a hired man. A soldier, maybe. The way he wears his sword, it's part of him, like his hand or his foot. He makes the merchant's guards look like cur dogs." "And her, Rand? I never even imagined anyone like her. She's out of a Gleeman story. She's like...
He paused to give Ewan a sour look.
"Like a high-born lady," he finished with a sigh.
"But who are they?" Rand asked. "Except for merchants, once a year to buy tobacco and wool, and the peddlers, outsiders never came into the Two Rivers, or as good as never. Maybe at Tarn Ferry, but not this far south. Most of the merchants and peddlers have been coming for years, too, so they did not really count as strangers, just outsiders. It was a good 5 years since the last time a real stranger appeared in Emmonsfield, and he had been trying to hide from some sort of trouble up in Bearlawn that nobody in the village understood. He had not stayed long."
"What do they want?" "What do they want?" Matt exclaimed. "I don't care what they want. Strangers, Rand. And strangers like you never even dreamed of. Think of it."
Rand opened his mouth, then closed it without speaking. The black-cloaked rider had him as nervous as a cat in a dog run. It just seemed like an awful coincidence, 3 strangers around the village at the same time. 3, if this fellow's cloak that changed colors never changed to black.
Her name is Moraine,
Ewan said in the momentary silence.
I heard him say it. Moraine, he called her. The Lady Moraine. His name is Lan. The Wisdom may not like her, but I do.
What makes you think Nynaeve dislikes her? Rand said.
She asked the Wisdom for directions this morning, Ewan said, and called her child.
Rand and Matt both whistled softly through their teeth, and Ewan tripped over his tongue in his haste to explain.
The Lady Moraine didn't know she was the Wisdom. She apologized when she found out. She did. And asked some questions about herbs and about who is who around Ewan's field, just as respectfully as any woman in the village. More so than some. She's always asking questions about how old people are and how long they've lived where they live, and, oh, I don't know what all. Anyway, Nynaeve answered like she'd bitten a green sweet berry. Then, when the Lady Moraine walked away, Nynaeve stared after her like... Well, he wasn't friendly, I can tell you that.
Is that all? Rand said.
You know Nynaeve's temper. When Senbui called her a child last year, she thumped him on the head with her stick. And he's in the village council, and old enough to be her grandfather besides. She flares up at anything, and never stays angry past turning around. That's too long for me, Ewan muttered. I don't care who Nynaeve thumps, Matt chortled, so long as it isn't me. This is going to be the best Beltane ever. A gleeman, a lady, who could ask for more? Who needs fireworks? A gleeman? Ewan said, his voice rising sharply. Come on, Rand,
Matt went on, ignoring the younger boy.
We're done here. You have to see this fellow.
He bounded up the stairs with Ewan scrambling behind him, calling,
Is there really a gleeman, Matt? This isn't like the ghost towns, is it? Or the frogs?
Rand paused long enough to turn down the lamp, then hurried after them. In the common room, Rowan Hearn and Samuel Craw had joined the others in the front of the fire, so that the entire village council was there. Bran Alvear spoke now, his normally bluff voice pitched so low that only a rumbling murmur traveled beyond the close-gathered chairs. The mayor emphasized his words by tapping a thick forefinger into the palm of his other hand and eyed each man in turn. They all nodded in agreement with whatever he was saying, though Sen more reluctantly than the rest. The way the men all but huddled together spoke more plainly than a painted sign. Whatever they were talking about, it was for the village council alone, at least for now. They would not appreciate Rand trying to listen in. Reluctantly, he pulled himself away. There was still the gleeman. And these strangers. Outside, Bella and the cart were gone, taken away by Hugh or Tad, the inn's stableman. Matt and Ewan stood glaring at one another a few paces from the front door of the inn, their cloaks whipping in the wind.
For the last time, Matt barked, I am not playing a trick on you. There is a gleeman. Now go away. Rand, will you tell this woolhead I am telling the truth so he'll leave me alone?
Pulling his cloak together, Rand stepped forward to support Matt, but words died as the hairs stirred on the back of his neck. He was being watched again. It was far from the feeling the hooded rider had given him, but neither was it pleasant, especially so soon after that encounter. A quick look about the green showed him only what he had seen before. Children playing, people preparing for festival, and no one more than glancing in his direction. The spring pole stood alone now, waiting. Bustle and childish shouts filled the side streets. All was as it should be, except that he was being watched. Then something led him to turn around, to raise his eyes. On the edge of the inn's tile roof perched a large raven, swaying a little in the gusting wind from the mountains. Its head was cocked to one side, and one beady black eye was focused on him, he thought. He swallowed, and suddenly anger flickered in him, hot and sharp.
Filthy carrion eater, he muttered. I am tired of being stared at, Matt growled.
And Rand realized his friend had stepped up beside him and was frowning at the raven, too. They exchanged a glance, then as one their hands darted for rocks. The two stones flew true, and the raven stepped aside. The stones whistled through the space where it had been. Fluffing its wings once, it cocked its head again, fixing them with a dead black eye, unafraid, giving no sign that anything had happened. Rand stared at the bird in consternation.
Did you ever see a raven do that?
He asked quietly. Matt shook his head without looking away from the raven.
Never. Nor any other bird either.
A vile bird?
Came a woman's voice from behind them, melodious despite echoes of distaste.
To be mistrusted in the best of times.
With a shrill cry, the raven launched itself into the air so violently that two black feathers drifted down from the roof's edge. Startled, Rand and Matt twisted to follow the bird's swift flight over the green and toward the cloud-tipped mountains of mist, tall beyond the westward, until it dwindled to a speck in the west, then vanished from view. Rand's gaze fell to the woman who had spoken. She, too, had been watching the flight of the raven, but now she turned back and her eyes met his. He could only stare. This had to be the Lady Moraine, and she was everything that Matt and Ewan had said. Everything and more. When he had heard she called Nynaeve a child, he had pictured her as old, but she was not. At least, he could not put any age to her at all. At first he thought she was as young as Nynaeve, but the longer he looked, the more he thought she was older than that. There was a maturity about her large, dark eyes, a hint of knowing that no one could have gotten young. For an instant he thought those eyes were deep pools about to swallow him up. It was plain why Matt and Ewan named her a lady from a gleeman's tale, too. She held herself with a grace and air of command that made him feel awkward and stumble-footed. She was barely tall enough to come up to his chest, but her presence was such that her height seemed the proper one, and he felt ungainly in his tallness. Altogether, she was like no one he had ever seen before. The wide hood of her cloak framed her face and dark hair, hanging in soft ringlets. He had never seen a grown woman with her hair unbraided. Every girl in the Two Rivers waited eagerly for the woman's circle of her village to say she was old enough to wear a braid. Her clothes were just as strange. Her cloak was sky-blue velvet, with thick silver embroidery, leaves and vines and flowers all along the edges. Her dress gleamed faintly as she moved, a darker blue than the cloak, and slashed with cream. A necklace of heavy gold links hung around her neck, while another gold chain, delicate and fastened in her hair, supported a small, sparkling blue stone in the middle of her forehead. A wide belt of woven gold encircled her waist, and on the second finger of her left hand was a gold ring in the shape of a serpent biting its own tail. He had certainly never seen a ring like that, though he recognized the great serpent, an even older symbol for eternity than the Wheel of Time. Fancier than any feast day clothes, Ewan had said, and he was right. No one ever dressed like that in the Two Rivers. Not ever.
Good morning, Mistress, Lady Moraine, Rand said.
His face grew hot at his tongue's fumbling.
Good morning, Lady Moraine,
Matt echoed somewhat more smoothly, but only a little. She smiled, and Rand found himself wondering if there was anything he might do for her, something that would give him an excuse to stay near her. He knew she was smiling at all of them, but it seemed meant for him alone. It really was just like seeing a gleeman's tale come to life. Matt had a foolish grin on his face.
You know my name, she said, sounding delighted.
As if her presence, however brief, would not be the talk of the village for a year.
But you must call me Moraine, not Lady. And what are your names?
Ewan leaped forward before either of the others could speak. My name is Ewan Fingar, my lady. I told them your name, that's how they know. I heard Lan say it, but I wasn't eavesdropping. No one like you has ever come to Emmonsfield before. There's a gleeman in the village for Beltane, too. And tonight is winter night. Will you come to my house? My mother has apple cakes.
I shall have to see,
she replied, putting a hand on Ewan's shoulder. Her eyes twinkled with amusement, though she gave no other sign of it.
I do not know how well I could compete against a gleeman, Ewan, but you must call me Moraine.
She looked expectantly at Rand and Matt.
I'm Matrim Cawthon, Moraine, Matt said.
He made a stiff, jerking bow, then went red in the face as he straightened. Rand had been wondering if he should do something of the sort, the way men did in stories, but with Matt's example, he merely spoke his name. At least he did not stumble over his own tongue this time. Moraine looked from him to Matt and back again.
Rand thought her smile, a bare curve of the corners of her mouth, was now the sort Egwene wore when she had a secret.
"I may have some small tasks to be done from time to time while I am in Emmonsfield," she said. "Perhaps you would be willing to assist me?"
She laughed as their assents tumbled over one another.
"Here," she said, and Rand was surprised when she pressed a coin into his palm,
closing his hand tightly around it with both of hers.
"There's no need," he began,
but she waved aside his protest as she gave Ewan a coin as well, then pressed Matt's hand around one the same way she had Rand's.
"Of course there is," she said. "You cannot be expected to work for nothing. Consider this a token, and keep it with you, so you will remember that you have agreed to come to me when I ask it. There is a bond between us now."
"I'll never forget,"
Ewan piped up.
"Later we must talk," she said, "and you must tell me all about yourselves."
Moraine,
Rand asked hesitantly as she turned away. She stopped and looked back over her shoulder, and he had to swallow before going on.
"Why have you come to Emmonsfield?"
Her expression was unchanged, but suddenly he wished he had not asked, though he could not have said why. He rushed to explain himself anyway.
"I don't mean to be rude. I'm sorry. It's just that no one comes into the Two Rivers except the merchants and peddlers when the snow isn't too deep to get down from Bearlon. Almost no one. Certainly no one like you.
The merchants' guards sometimes say this is the back end of forever, and I suppose it must seem that way to anyone from outside.
I just wondered."
Her smile did fade then, slowly, as if something had been recalled to her. For a moment, she merely looked at him.
"I am a student of history," she said at last, "a collector of old stories. This place you call the Two Rivers has always interested me. Sometimes I study the stories of what happened here long ago, here and at other places."
"Stories?" Rand said.
"Whatever happened in the Two Rivers to interest someone like... what could have happened here?"
"And what else would you call it beside the Two Rivers?" Matt added. "That's what it has always been called."
"As the wheel of time turns," Moraine said, half to herself and with a distant look in her eyes, "places wear many names. Men wear many names, many faces. Different faces, but always the same man. Yet no one knows the great pattern the wheel weaves, or even the pattern of an age. We can only watch and study and hope."
Rand stared at her, unable to say a word, even to ask what she meant. He was not sure she had meant for them to hear. The other two were just as tongue-tied, he noticed. Ewan's mouth hung open. Moraine focused on them again, and all three gave a little shake as if waking up.
"Later we will talk," she said.
None of them said a word.
"Later."
She moved on toward the wagon bridge, appearing to glide over the ground rather than walk, her cloak spreading on either side of her like wings. As she left, a tall man Rand had not noticed before moved away from the front of the inn and followed her, one hand resting on the long hilt of a sword. His clothes were a dark grayish green that would have faded into leaf or shadow, and his cloak swirled through shades of gray and green and brown as it shifted in the wind. It almost seemed to disappear at times, that cloak, fading into whatever lay beyond it. His hair was long and gray at the temples, held back from his face by a narrow leather headband. That face was made from stony planes and angles, weathered but unlined despite the gray in his hair. When he moved, Rand could think of nothing but a wolf. In passing the three youths, his gaze ran over them, eyes as cold and blue as a midwinter dawn. It was as if he were weighing them in his mind, and there was no sign on his face of what the scales told him. He quickened his pace until he caught up to Moraine, then slowed to a walk by her shoulder, bending to speak to her. Rand let out a breath he had not realized he had been holding.
"That was Lon,"
Ewan said throatily, as if he too had been holding his breath.
It had been that kind of look.
"I'll bet he's a warder."
"Don't be a fool," Matt laughed, but it was a shaky laugh. "Warders are just in stories. Anyway, warders have swords and armor covered in gold and jewels, and spend all their time up north in the Great Blight, fighting evil and Trollocs and such."
"He could be a warder," Ewan insisted.
Did you see any jewels or gold on him? Matt scoffed. Do we have Trollocs in the Two Rivers? We have sheep. I wonder what could ever have happened here to interest someone like her.
Something could have, Rand answered slowly. They say the inn's been here for 1,000 years, maybe more.
1,000 years of sheep, Matt said.
A silver penny, Ewan burst out. She gave me a whole silver penny. Think what I can buy when the peddler comes.
Rand opened his hand to look at the coin she had given him and almost dropped it in surprise. He did not recognize the fat silver coin with the raised image of a woman balancing a single flame on her upturned hand. But he had watched while Bran Alvir weighed out the coins merchants brought from 12 lands, and he had an idea of its value. That much silver would buy a good horse anywhere in the Two Rivers, with some left over. He looked at Matt and saw the same stunned expression he knew must be on his own face. Tilting his hand so Matt could see the coin, but not Ewan, he raised a questioning eyebrow. Matt nodded, and for a minute they stared at one another in perplexed wonder.
"What kind of chores does she have?" Rand asked finally.
"I don't know," Matt said firmly, "and I don't care. I won't spend it either, even when the peddler comes." With that, he thrust his coin into his coat pocket. Nodding, Rand slowly did the same with his. He was not sure why, but somehow what Matt said seemed right. The coin should not be spent. Not when it came from her. He could not think of anything else silver was good for, but...
"Do you think I should keep mine, too?"
Anguished indecision painted Ewan's face.
"Not unless you want to," Matt said.
"I think she gave it to you to spend," Rand said. Ewan looked at his coin, then shook his head and stuffed the silver penny into his pocket.
"I'll keep it," he said mournfully.
"There's still the Gleeman," Rand said, and the younger boy brightened.
"If he ever wakes up," Matt added.
"Rand," Ewan asked,
"is there a Gleeman?"
"You'll see," Rand answered with a laugh. It was clear Ewan would not believe until he set eyes on the Gleeman. "He has to come down sooner or later." Shouting drifted across the wagon bridge, and when Rand looked to see what was causing it, his laughter became wholehearted. A milling crowd of villagers, from gray-haired oldsters to toddlers barely able to walk, escorted a tall wagon toward the bridge, a huge wagon drawn by 8 horses. The outside of its rounded canvas cover hung about with bundles like bunches of grapes. The peddler had come at last. Strangers and a gleeman, fireworks and a peddler. It was going to be the best Beltane ever. Chapter 3 The Peddler. Clusters of pots clattered and banged as the peddler's wagon rumbled over the heavy timbers of the wagon bridge. Still surrounded by a cloud of villagers and farmers come for festival, the peddler reined his horses to a stop in front of the inn. From every direction people streamed to swell the numbers around the great wagon, its wheels taller than any of the people, with their eyes fastened to the peddler above them on the wagon seat. The man on the wagon was Padan Fane, a pale, skinny fellow with gangly arms and a massive beak of a nose. Fane, always smiling and laughing as if he knew a joke that no one else knew, had driven his wagon and team into Emmons Field every spring for as long as Rand could remember. The door of the inn flew open even as the team halted in a jangle of harness, and the village council appeared, led by Master Alvir and Tam. They marched out deliberately, even Senbui, amid all the excited shouting of the others for pins or lace or books or 12 other things. Reluctantly, the crowd parted to let them to the fore, everyone closing in quickly behind and never stopping their calling to the peddler. Most of all, the villagers called for news. In the eyes of the villagers, needles and tea and the like were no more than half the freight in a peddler's wagon. Every bit as important was word of outside, news of the world beyond the Two Rivers. Some peddlers simply told what they knew, throwing it out in a heap, a pile of rubbish with which they could not be bothered. Others had to have every word dragged out of them, speaking grudgingly, with a bad grace. Fane, however, spoke freely, if often teasingly, and spun out the telling, making a show to rival a gleeman. He enjoyed being the center of attention, strutting around like an undersized rooster, with every eye on him. It occurred to Rand that Fane might not be best pleased to find a real gleeman in Emmons Field. The peddler gave the council and villagers alike exactly the same attention as he fussed with tying his reins off just so, which was to say hardly any attention at all. He nodded casually at no one in particular.
He smiled without speaking, and waved absently to people with whom he was particularly friendly, though his friendliness had always been of a peculiarly distant kind, backslapping without ever getting close. The demands for him to speak grew louder, but Fane waited, fiddling with small tasks about the driver's seat, for the crowd and the anticipation to reach the size he wanted. The council alone kept silent. They maintained the dignity befitting their position, but increasing clouds of pipe smoke rising above their heads showed the effort of it. Rand and Matt edged into the crowd, getting as close to the wagon as they could. Rand would have stopped halfway, but Matt wriggled through the press, pulling Rand behind him, until they were right behind the council.
"I've been thinking you were going to stay out on the farm through the whole festival,"
Perrin Ebarra shouted at Rand over the clamor.
Half a head shorter than Rand, the curly-haired blacksmith's apprentice was so stocky as to seem a man and a half wide, with arms and shoulders thick enough to rival those of Master Luhan himself. He could easily have pushed through the throng, but that was not his way. He picked his path carefully, offering apologies to people who had only half a mind to notice anything but the peddler. He made the apologies anyway and tried not to jostle anyone as he worked through the crowd to Rand and Matt.
"Imagine it," he said when he finally reached them. "Beltine and a peddler, both together. I'll bet there really are fireworks."
"You don't know a quarter of it," Matt laughed.
Perrin eyed him suspiciously, then looked a question at Rand.
"It's true," Rand shouted, then gestured at the growing mass of people, all giving voice. "Later. I'll explain later. Later, I said."
At that moment, Padan Fane stood up on the wagon seat, and the crowd quieted in an instant. Rand's last words exploded into utter silence, catching the peddler with an arm raised dramatically and his mouth open. Everybody turned to stare at Rand. The bony little man on the wagon, prepared to have everyone hanging on his first words, gave Rand a sharp, searching look. Rand's face reddened, and he wished he were Ewen's size, so he did not stand out so clearly. His friends shifted uncomfortably, too. It had only been the year before that Fane had taken notice of them for the first time, acknowledging them as men. Fane did not usually have time for anyone too young to buy a good deal of things off his wagon. Rand hoped he had not been relegated to a child again in the peddler's eyes. With a loud harumph, Fane tugged at his heavy cloak.
"No, not later," the peddler declaimed, once more throwing up a hand grandly. "I will be telling you now."
As he spoke, he made broad gestures, casting his words over the crowd.
"You are thinking you have had troubles in the Two Rivers, are you? Well, all the world has troubles, from the Great Blight south to the Sea of Storms, from the Arith Ocean in the west to the Aiel Waste in the east, and even beyond. The winter was harsher than you've ever seen before, cold enough to gel your blood and crack your bones. Ah, winter was cold and harsh everywhere. In the borderlands they be calling your winter spring. But spring does not come, you say. Wolves have killed your sheep. Perhaps wolves have attacked men. Is that the way of it? Well now, spring is late everywhere. There are wolves everywhere, all hungry for any flesh they can sink a tooth into, be it sheep or cow or man. But there are things worse than wolves or winter. There are those who would be glad to have only your little troubles."
He paused expectantly.
"What could be worse than wolves killing sheep and men?"
Senbui demanded. Others muttered in support.
"Men killing men."
The peddler's reply, in portentous tones, brought shocked murmurs that increased as he went on.
"It is war, I mean. There is war in Gialdan. War and madness. The snows of the Dalin Forest are red with the blood of men. Ravens and the cries of ravens fill the air. Armies march to Gialdan. Nations, great houses and great men send their soldiers to fight. War!"
Master Alvir's mouth fit awkwardly around the unfamiliar word. No one in the Two Rivers had ever had anything to do with a war.
"Why are they having a war?"
Fane grinned, and Rand had the feeling he was mocking the villagers' isolation from the world and their ignorance. The peddler leaned forward as if he were about to impart a secret to the mayor, but his whisper was meant to carry, and did.
"The standard of the dragon has been raised, and men flock to oppose, and to support."
One long gasp left every throat together, and Rand shivered in spite of himself.
"The dragon!"
someone moaned.
"The Dark One's loose in Gil'dan?"
"Not the Dark One,"
Aral Luhan growled.
"The dragon's not the Dark One, and this is a false dragon anyway."
"Let's hear what Master Fane has to say,"
the mayor said. But no one would be quieted that easily. People cried out from every side, men and women shouting over one another.
"Just as bad as the Dark One. The dragon broke the world, didn't he? He started it. He caused the time of madness. You know the prophecies. When the dragon is reborn, your worst nightmares will seem like your fondest dreams. He's just another false dragon. He must be."
"What difference does that make? You remember the last false dragon? He started a war, too. Thousands died. Isn't that right, Fane? He laid siege to Ilion."
"It's evil times. No one claiming to be the dragon reborn for 20 years, and now 3 in the last 5 years. Evil times. Look at the weather."
Rand exchanged looks with Matt and Perrin. Matt's eyes shone with excitement, but Perrin wore a worried frown. Rand could remember every tale he had heard about the men who named themselves the Dragon Reborn, and if they had all proven themselves false dragons by dying or disappearing without fulfilling any of the prophecies, what they had done was bad enough. Whole nations torn by battle, and cities and towns put to the torch. The dead fell like autumn leaves, and refugees clogged the roads like sheep in a pen. So the peddlers said, and the merchants, and no one in the Two Rivers with any sense doubted it. The world would end, so some said, when the real dragon was born again.
"Stop this!" the mayor shouted. "Be quiet! Stop working yourselves to a lather out of your own imaginations! Let Master Fane tell us about this false dragon!"
The people began to quieten, but Sen Bui refused to be silent.
"Is this a false dragon?"
the thatcher asked sourly. Master Alvir blinked as if taken by surprise, then snapped,
"Don't be an old fool, Sen!"
But Sen had kindled the crowd again.
"He can't be the dragon reborn! Light help us! He can't be!
You old fool, Bui! You want bad luck, don't you?
Be naming the Dark One next! You're taken by the dragon, Sen Bui, trying to bring us all harm!"
Sen looked around defiantly, trying to stare down the glowers, and raised his voice.
"I didn't hear Fane say this was a false dragon, did you? Use your eyes! Where are the crops that should be knee-high or better? Why is it still winter when spring should be here a month?"
There were angry shouts for Sen to hold his tongue.
"I will not be silent. I've no liking for this talk either. But I won't hide my head under a basket till a Taran ferryman comes to cut my throat. And I won't dangle on Fane's pleasure, not this time. Speak it out plain, peddler. What have you heard, eh? Is this man a false dragon?"
If Fane was perturbed by the news he brought, or the upset he had caused, he gave no sign of it. He merely shrugged and laid his skinny finger alongside his nose.
"As to that, now, who can say until it is over and done?"
He paused, with one of his secretive grins, running his eyes over the crowd as if imagining how they would react and finding it funny.
"I do know," he said, too casually, "that he can wield the One Power. The others couldn't, but he can channel. The ground opens beneath his enemy's feet, and strong walls crumble at his shout. Lightning comes when he calls and strikes where he points. That I've heard, and from men I believe."
A stunned silence fell. Rand looked at his friends. Perrin seemed to be seeing things he did not like, but Matt still looked excited. Tam, his face only a little less composed than usual, drew the mayor close. But before he could speak, Ewen Fingar burst out,
"He'll go mad and die. In the stories, men who channel the power always go mad, and then waste away and die. Only women can touch it. Doesn't he know that?"
He ducked under a cuff from Master Bui.
"Enough of that from you, boy."
Sen shook a gnarled fist in Ewen's face.
"Show a proper respect, and leave this to your elders. Get away with you."
"Hold steady, Sen," Tam growled. "The boy is just curious. There's no need of this foolishness from you."
"Act your age," Bran added, "and for once remember you're a member of the council."
Sen's wrinkled face grew darker with every word from Tam and the mayor, until it was almost purple.
"You know what kind of women he's talking about. Stop frowning at me, Luhan, and you too, Craw."
This is a decent village of decent folk, and it's bad enough to have Fane here talking about false dragons using the power without this dragon-possessed fool of a boy bringing Aes Sedai into it. Some things just shouldn't be talked about, and I don't care if you will be letting that fool Gleeman tell any kind of tale he wants. It isn't right or decent.
I never saw or heard or smelled anything that couldn't be talked about, Tam said, but Fane was not finished.
The Aes Sedai are already into it, the peddler spoke up. A party of them has ridden south from Tar Valon. Since he can wield the power, none but the Aes Sedai can defeat him, for all the battles they fight, or deal with him once he's defeated. If he is defeated.
Someone in the crowd moaned aloud, and even Tam and Bran exchanged uneasy frowns.
Huddles of villagers clumped together, and some pulled their cloaks tighter around themselves, though the wind had actually lessened.
Of course he'll be defeated, someone shouted. They're always beaten in the end, false dragons.
He has to be defeated, doesn't he?
What if he isn't?
Tam had finally managed to speak quietly into the mayor's ear, and Bran, nodding from time to time and ignoring the hubbub around them, waited until he was finished before raising his own voice.
All of you, listen. Be quiet and listen.
The shouting died to a murmur again.
This goes beyond mere news from outside. It must be discussed by the village council. Master Fane, if you will join us inside the inn, we have questions to ask.
A good mug of hot mulled wine would not go far amiss with me just now, the peddler replied with a chuckle. He jumped down from the wagon, dusted his hands on his coat, and cheerfully righted his cloak. Will you be looking after my horses, if you please?
I want to hear what he has to say.
More than one voice was raised in protest.
You can't take him off! My wife sent me to buy pins!
That was Whit Conger. He hunched his shoulders at the stares some of the others gave him, but he held his ground.
We've a right to ask questions, too, somebody back in the crowd shouted. Aye. Be silent,
the mayor roared, producing a startled hush.
When the council has asked its questions, Master Fane will be back to tell you all his news, and to sell you his pots and pins. You, Tad, stable Master Fane's horses.
Tam and Bran moved in on either side of the peddler, and the rest of the council gathered behind them. And the whole cluster swept into the wine spring inn, firmly shutting the door in the faces of those who tried to crowd inside after them. Pounding on the door brought only a single shout from the mayor.
Go home!
People milled around in front of the inn, muttering about what the peddler had said, and what it meant, and what questions the council was asking, and why they should be allowed to listen and ask questions of their own. Some peered in through the front windows of the inn, and a few even questioned Hugh and Tad, though it was far from clear what they were supposed to know. The two stolid stablemen just grunted in reply and went on methodically removing the team's harness. One by one, they led Fane's horses away, and when the last was gone, did not return. Rand ignored the crowd. He took a seat on the edge of the old stone foundation, gathered his cloak around him, and stared at the inn door. Gil'dan, Tar Valon. The very names were strange and exciting. They were places he knew only from peddler's news and tales told by merchants' guards. Aes Sedai, and wars and false dragons. Those were the stuff of stories told late at night in front of the fireplace, with one candle making strange shapes in the wall and the wind howling against the shutters. On the whole, he believed he would rather have blizzards and wolves. Still, it must be different out there, beyond the two rivers. Like living in the middle of a gleeman's tale. An adventure. One long adventure. A whole lifetime of it. Slowly the villagers dispersed, still muttering and shaking their heads. Whit Conger paused to stare into the now abandoned wagon, as though he might find another peddler hidden inside. Finally, only a few of the younger folk were left. Matt and Perrin drifted over to where Rand sat.
I don't see how the Gleeman could beat this, Matt said excitedly. I wonder if we might get to see this false dragon.
Perrin shook his shaggy head.
I don't want to see him. Somewhere else, maybe, but not in the two rivers. Not if it means war.
Not if it means Aes Sedai here, either, Rand added. Or have you forgotten who caused the breaking? The dragon may have started it, but it was Aes Sedai who actually broke the world.
I heard a story once, Matt said slowly, from a wool buyer's guard. He said the dragon would be reborn in mankind's greatest hour of need and save us all.
Well, he was a fool if he believed that, Perrin said firmly. And you were a fool to listen.
He did not sound angry. He was slow to anger. But he sometimes got exasperated with Matt's quicksilver fancies, and there was a touch of that in his voice.
I suppose he claimed we'd all live in a new age of legends afterwards, too.
I didn't say I believed it, Matt protested. I just heard it.
Nynaeve did, too, and I thought she was going to skin me and the guard both.
He said, the guard did, that a lot of people do believe, only they're afraid to say so, afraid of the Aes Sedai, or the Children of the Light. He wouldn't say any more after Nynaeve lit into us. She told the merchant, and he said it was the guard's last trip with him.
A good thing, too, Perrin said. The dragon going to save us? Sounds like Copland talked to me.
What kind of need would be great enough that we'd want the dragon to save us from it? Rand mused.
As well ask for help from the Dark One.
He didn't say, Matt replied uncomfortably, and he didn't mention any New Age of Legends. He said the world would be torn apart by the dragon's coming.
That would surely save us, Perrin said dryly. Another breaking.
Burn me, Matt growled. I'm only telling you what the guard said.
Perrin shook his head.
I just hope the Aes Sedai and this dragon, false or not, stay where they are. Maybe that way the Two Rivers will be spared.
You think they're really dark friends? Matt was frowning thoughtfully.
Who? Rand asked.
Aes Sedai.
Rand glanced at Perrin, who shrugged.
The stories, he began slowly, but Matt cut him off.
Not all the stories say they serve the Dark One, Rand.
Like Matt, Rand said. They caused the breaking. What more do you want?
I suppose. Matt sighed, but the next moment he was grinning again.
Old Billy Conger says they don't exist, Aes Sedai, Dark Friends. Says they're just stories. He says he doesn't believe in the Dark One either.
Perrin snorted.
Copland talk from a conger. What else can you expect?
Oh, Billy named the Dark One. I'll bet you didn't know that.
Light, Rand breathed.
Matt's grin broadened.
It was last spring, just before the cutworm got into his fields and nobody else's. Right before everybody in his house came down with yellow eye fever. I heard him do it. He still says he doesn't believe it. But whenever I ask him to name the Dark One now, he throws something at me. You're just stupid enough to do that, aren't you, Matrim Coffin?
Nynaeve Almira stepped into their huddle, the dark braid pulled over her shoulder, almost bristling with anger. Rand scrambled to his feet. Slender and barely taller than Matt's shoulder, at the moment the wisdom seemed taller than any of them, and it did not matter that she was young and pretty.
I suspected something of the sort about Billy Conger at the time, but I thought you at least had more sense than to try taunting him into such a thing. You may be old enough to be married, Matrim Cawthon, but in truth, you shouldn't be off your mother's apron strings. The next thing, you'll be naming the Dark One yourself. No wisdom, Matt protested,
looking as if he would rather be anywhere else than there.
It was old Bill... I mean, Master Conger, not me. Blood and ashes, I...
Watch your tongue, Matrim.
Rand stood up straighter, though her glare was not directed at him. Perrin looked equally abashed. Later, one or another of them would almost certainly complain about being scolded by a woman not all that much older than themselves. Someone always did after one of Nynaeve's scoldings, if never in her hearing. But the gap in ages always seemed more than wide enough when face to face with her, especially if she was angry. The stick in her hand was thick at one end and a slender switch at the other, and she was liable to give a flail to anybody she thought was acting the fool. Head or hands or legs, no matter their age or position. The wisdom so held his attention that at first Rand failed to see she was not alone. When he realized his mistake, he began to think about leaving, no matter what Nynaeve would say or do later. Egwene stood a few paces from the wisdom, watching intently. Of a height with Nynaeve, and with the same dark coloring, she could at that moment have been a reflection of Nynaeve's mood, arms crossed beneath her breasts, mouth tight with disapproval. The hood of her soft gray cloak shaded her face, and her big brown eyes held no laughter now. If there was any fairness, he thought that being 2 years older than her should give him some advantage, but that was not the way of it. At the best of times, he was never very nimble with his tongue when talking to any of the village girls, not like Perrin.
But whenever Egwene gave him that intent look, with her eyes as wide as they would go, as if every last ounce of her attention was on him, he just could not seem to make the words go where he wanted. Perhaps he could get away as soon as Nynaeve finished. But he knew he would not, even if he did not understand why.
"If you are done staring like a moonstruck lamb, Randall Thor," Nynaeve said, "perhaps you can tell me why you are talking about something even you three great bull calves ought to have sense enough to keep out of your mouths?"
Rand gave a start and pulled his eyes away from Egwene. She had grown a disconcerting smile when the wisdom began speaking. Nynaeve's voice was tart, but she had the beginnings of a knowing smile on her face, too, until Matt laughed aloud. The wisdom's smile vanished, and the look she gave Matt cut his laughter off in a strangled croak.
"Well, Rand?" Nynaeve said.
Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Egwene still smiling. What does she think is so funny?
"It was natural enough to talk of it, Wisdom," he said hurriedly. "The peddler, Padan Fane, Master Fane, brought news of a false dragon in Gil'dan, and a war, and the Aes Sedai. The council thought it was important enough to talk to him. What else will we be talking about?"
Nynaeve shook her head.
"So that's why the peddler's wagon stands abandoned. I heard people rushing to meet it, but I couldn't leave Mistress Aiellen till her fever broke. The council is questioning the peddler about what's happening in Gil'dan, are they? If I know them, they are asking all the wrong questions, and none of the right ones. It will take the women's circle to find out anything useful."
Settling her cloak firmly on her shoulders, she disappeared into the inn. Egwene did not follow the wisdom. As the inn door closed behind Nynaeve, the younger woman came to stand in front of Rand. The frowns were gone from her face, but her unblinking stare made him uneasy. He looked to his friends, but they moved away, grinning broadly as they abandoned him.
"You shouldn't let Matt get you mixed up in his foolishness, Rand," Egwene said, as solemn as a wisdom herself. Then abruptly she giggled. "I haven't seen you look like that since Senbui caught you and Matt up in his apple trees when you were 10.
He shifted his feet and glanced at his friends.
They stood not far away, Matt gesturing excitedly as he talked. "Will you dance with me tomorrow?"
That was not what he had meant to say. He did want to dance with her, but at the same time he wanted nothing so little as the uncomfortable way he was sure to feel while he was with her. The way he felt right then. The corners of her mouth quirked up in a small smile.
"In the afternoon," she said. "I will be busy in the morning."
From the others came Perrin's exclamation.
"A gleeman!"
Egwene turned toward them, but Rand put a hand on her arm.
"Busy? How?"
Despite the chill, she pushed back the hood of her cloak and with apparent casualness pulled her hair forward over her shoulder. The last time he had seen her, her hair had hung in dark waves below her shoulders, with only a red ribbon keeping it back from her face. Now it was worked into a long braid. He stared at that braid as if it were a viper, then stole a glance at the spring pole, standing alone on the green now, ready for tomorrow. In the morning, unmarried women of marriageable age would dance the pole. He swallowed hard. Somehow, it had never occurred to him that she would reach marriageable age at the same time that he did. "Just because someone is old enough to marry," he muttered, "doesn't mean they should. Not right away."
"Of course not. Or ever, for that matter."
Rand blinked.
"Ever?" "A wisdom almost never marries. Nynaeve has been teaching me, you know. She says I have a talent, that I can learn to listen to the wind. Nynaeve says not all wisdoms can, even if they say they do."
"Wisdom?" he hooted.
He failed to notice the dangerous glint in her eye.
"Nynaeve will be wisdom here for another 50 years at least. Probably more. Are you going to spend the rest of your life as her apprentice?" "There are other villages," she replied heatedly. "Nynaeve says the villages north of Tarn always choose a wisdom from away. They think it stops her from having favorites among the village folk."
His amusement melted as fast as it had come.
"Outside the Two Rivers? I'd never see you again."
"And you wouldn't like that?
You have not given any sign lately that you'd care one way or another."
"No one ever leaves the Two Rivers," he went on.
"Maybe somebody from Tarn Ferry, but they're all strange anyway. Hardly like Two Rivers folk at all."
Egwene gave an exasperated sigh.
Well, maybe I'm strange, too. Maybe I want to see some of the places I hear about in the stories. Have you ever thought of that?
Of course I have. I daydream sometimes, but I know the difference between daydreams and what's real.
And I do not,
she said furiously, and promptly turned her back on him.
That wasn't what I meant. I was talking about me. Egwene?
She jerked her cloak around her, a wall to shut him off, and stiffly walked a few paces away. He rubbed his head in frustration. How to explain? This was not the first time she had squeezed meanings from his words that he never knew were in them. In her present mood, a misstep would only make matters worse, and he was fairly sure that nearly anything he said would be a misstep. Matt and Perrin came back then. Egwene ignored their coming. They looked at her hesitantly, then crowded close to Rand.
Moraine gave Perrin a coin too, Matt said. Just like ours.
He paused before adding,
and he saw the rider.
Where? Rand demanded.
When? Did anybody else see him? Did you tell anyone?
Perrin raised broad hands in a slowing gesture.
One question at a time. I saw him on the edge of the village, watching the smithy. Just at twilight yesterday. Gave me the shivers, he did. I told Master Luhan, only nobody was there when he looked. He said I was seeing shadows. But he carried his biggest hammer around with him while we were banking the forge fire and putting the tools up. He's never done that before.
So he believed you, Rand said, but Perrin shrugged.
I don't know. I asked him why he was carrying the hammer if all I saw was shadows, and he said something about wolves getting bold enough to come into the village.
Maybe he thought that's what I saw, but he ought to know I can tell the difference between a wolf and a man on horseback, even at dusk. I know what I saw, and nobody is going to make me believe different.
I believe you, Rand said. Remember, I saw him too.
Perrin gave a satisfied grunt, as if he had not been sure of that.
What are you talking about? Egwene demanded suddenly.
Rand suddenly wished he had spoken more quietly. He would have, if he had realized she was listening. Matt and Perrin, grinning like fools, fell all over themselves telling her of their encounters with the black-cloaked rider. But Rand kept silent. He was sure he knew what she would say when they were done.
Nynaeve was right,
Egwene announced to the sky when the two youths fell silent.
None of you is ready to be off leading strings. People do ride horses, you know. That doesn't make them monsters out of a gleeman's tail.
Rand nodded to himself. It was just as he thought. She rounded on him.
And you've been spreading these tales. Sometimes you have no sense, Randall Thor. The winter has been frightening enough without you going about scaring the children.
Rand gave a sour grimace.
I haven't spread anything, Egwene. But I saw what I saw, and it was no farmer out looking for a strayed cow.
Egwene drew a deep breath and opened her mouth. But whatever she had been going to say vanished as the door of the inn opened, and a man with shaggy white hair came hurrying out as if pursued. Chapter 4 The Gleeman. The door of the inn banged shut behind the white-haired man, and he spun around to glare at it. Lean, he would have been tall if not for a stoop to his shoulders, but he moved in a spry fashion that belied his apparent age. His cloak seemed a mass of patches, in odd shapes and sizes, fluttering with every breath of air, patches in 100 colors. It was really quite thick, Rand saw, despite what Master Alvir had said, with the patches merely sewn on like decorations.
"The Gleeman," Egwene whispered excitedly.
The white-haired man whirled, cloak flaring. His long coat had odd baggy sleeves and big pockets. Thick mustaches, as snowy as the hair on his head, quivered around his mouth, and his face was gnarled like a tree that had seen hard times. He gestured imperiously at Rand and the others with a long-stemmed pipe, ornately carved, that trailed a wisp of smoke. Blue eyes peered out from under bushy white brows, drilling into whatever he looked at. Rand stared at the man's eyes almost as much as at the rest of him. Everybody in the Two Rivers had dark eyes, and so did most of the merchants, and their guards, and everyone else he had ever seen. The Congers and the Coplins had made fun of him for his gray eyes, until the day he finally punched Ewol Coplin in the nose. The wisdom had surely gotten onto him for that. He wondered if there was a place where nobody had dark eyes.
Maybe land comes from there, too.
What sort of place is this?
The Gleeman demanded in a deep voice that sounded in some way larger than that of an ordinary man. Even in the open air, it seemed to fill a great room and resonate from the walls.
The yokels in that village on the hill tell me I can get here before dark, neglecting to say that that was only if I left well before noon. When I finally do arrive, chilled to the bone and ready for a warm bed, your innkeeper grumbles about the hour as if I were a wandering swineherd, and your village council hadn't begged me to display my art at this festival of yours. And he never even told me he was the mayor.
He slowed for a breath, taking them all in with a glare, but he was off again on the instant.
When I came downstairs to smoke my pipe before the fire and have a mug of ale, every man in the common room stares at me as if I were his least favorite brother-in-law seeking to borrow money. One old grandfather starts ranting at me about the kind of stories I should or should not tell. Then a girl-child shouts at me to get out, and threatens me with a great club when I don't move quickly enough for her. Who ever heard of treating a gleeman so?
Egwene's face was a study. Her goggle-eyed amaze at a gleeman in the flesh, marred by a desire to defend Nynaeve.
"Your pardon, Master Gleeman," Rand said.
He knew he was grinning foolishly himself.
"That was our wisdom, and—"
"That pretty little slip of a girl?"
the Gleeman exclaimed.
"A village wisdom? Why, at her age she should be better flirting with the young men than foretelling the weather and curing the sick."
Rand shifted uncomfortably. He hoped Nynaeve never overheard the man's opinion. At least, not until he had done with his performing. Perrin winced at the Gleeman's words, and Matt whistled soundlessly, as if both had had the same thought as he had.
"The men were the village council," Rand went on. "I'm sure they intended no discourtesy. You see, we just learned there's a war in Gildan, and a man claiming to be the dragon reborn. A false dragon. Aes Sedai are riding there from Tar Valon. The council is trying to decide if we might be in danger here."
"Old news, even in Baerlon," the Gleeman said dismissively. "And that is the last place in the world to hear anything."
He paused, looking around the village, and dryly added,
"Almost the last place."
Then his eyes fell on the wagon in front of the inn, standing alone now, with its shafts on the ground.
"So, I thought I recognized Pa Dunfane in there."
His voice was still deep, but the resonance had gone, replaced by scorn.
"Fane was always one to carry bad news quickly, and the worse, the faster. There's more raven in him than man."
"Master Fane has come often to Emmons Field, Master Gleeman," Egwene said, a hint of disapproval finally breaking through her delight. "He is always full of laughter, and he brings much more good news than bad."
The Gleeman eyed her for a moment, then smiled broadly.
"Now you're a lovely lass. You should have rosebuds in your hair. Unfortunately, I cannot pull roses from the air, not this year. But how would you like to stand beside me tomorrow for a part of my performance? Hand me my flute when I want it, and certain other apparatus. I always choose the prettiest girl I can find as my assistant."
Perrin snickered, and Matt, who had been snickering, laughed out loud. Rand blinked in surprise. Egwene was glaring at him, and he had not even smiled. She straightened around and spoke in a too calm voice.
"Thank you, Master Gleeman. I would be happy to assist you."
"Tom Marilyn,"
the Gleeman said. They stared.
"My name is Tom Marilyn, not Master Gleeman."
He hitched the multi-hued cloak up on his shoulders, and abruptly his voice once more seemed to reverberate in a great hall.
"Once a court bard, I am now indeed risen to the exalted rank of Master Gleeman. Yet my name is plain Tom Marilyn, and Gleeman is the simple title in which I glory."
And he swept a bow so elaborate with flourishes of his cloak that Matt clapped and Egwene murmured appreciatively.
Master Marilyn, Matt said, unsure exactly what form of address to take out of what Tom Marilyn had said. "What is happening in Gildan? Do you know anything about this false dragon, or the Aes Sedai?"
"Do I look like a peddler, boy?"
the Gleeman grumbled, tapping out his pipe on the heel of his palm.
He made the pipe disappear somewhere inside his cloak or his coat. Rand was not sure where it had gone or how.
"I'm a gleeman, not a newsmonger. And I make a point of never knowing anything about Aes Sedai. Much safer that way."
"But the war," Matt began eagerly, only to be cut off by Master Merlin.
"In wars, boy, fools kill other fools for foolish causes. That's enough for anyone to know. I am here for my art."
Suddenly he thrust a finger at Rand.
"You, lad, you're a tall one. Not with your full growth on you yet, but I doubt there's another man in the district with your height. Not many in the village with eyes that color either, I'll wager. The point is, you're an axe handle across the shoulders and as tall as an Aiel man. What's your name, lad?"
Rand gave it hesitantly, not sure whether or not the man was making fun of him, but the gleeman had already turned his attention to Perrin.
"And you have almost the size of an Ogier. Close enough. How are you called?"
"Not unless I stand on my own shoulders," Perrin laughed. "I'm afraid Rand and I are just ordinary folk, Master Merlin, not made-up creatures from your stories. I'm Perrin Ebarra." Tom Merlin tugged at one of his mustaches.
"Well, now, made-up creatures from my stories. Is that what they are? You lads are widely traveled, then, it seems."
Rand kept his mouth shut, certainly with the butt of a joke now, but Perrin spoke up.
"We've all been as far as Watch Hill and Devon Ride. Not many around here have gone as far."
He was not boasting. Perrin seldom did. He was just telling the truth.
"We've all seen the mire, too," Matt added,
and he did sound boastful.
"That's the swamp at the far end of the Waterwood. Nobody at all goes there. It's full of quicksands and bogs. Except us. And nobody goes to the Mountains of Mist, either. But we did once. To the foot of them, anyway."
"As far as that," the gleeman murmured, brushing at his mustaches now continually.
Rand thought he was hiding a smile, and he saw that Perrin was frowning.
"It's bad luck to enter the mountains," Matt said, as if he had to defend himself for not going further. "Everybody knows that."
"That's just foolishness, Matrim Cawthon," Egwene cut in angrily. "Nynaeve says—"
She broke off, her cheeks turning pink, and the look she gave Tom Merlin was not as friendly as it had been.
"It is not right to make— It isn't—"
Her face went redder, and she fell silent. Matt blinked, as if he was just getting a suspicion of what had been going on.
"You're right, child," the gleeman said contritely. "I apologize humbly. I am here to entertain. Ah, my tongue has always gotten me into trouble."
"Maybe we haven't traveled as far as you," Perrin said flatly. "But what does how tall Rand is have to do with anything?"
"Just this, lad. A little later I will let you try to pick me up, but you won't be able to lift my feet from the ground. Not you, nor your tall friend there, Rand, is it? Nor any other man. Now what do you think of that?"
Perrin snorted a laugh.
"I think I can lift you right now."
But when he stepped forward, Tom Merlin motioned him back.
"Later, lad, later. When there are more folk to watch. An artist needs an audience."
A score of folk had gathered on the green since the gleeman appeared from the inn, young men and women down to children who peeked wide-eyed and silent from behind the older onlookers. All looked as if they were waiting for miraculous things from the gleeman. The white-haired man looked them over. He appeared to be counting them, then gave a slight shake of his head and sighed.
"I suppose I had better give you a small sample, so you can run tell the others, eh? Just a taste of what you'll see tomorrow at your festival."
He took a step back and suddenly leaped into the air, twisting and somersaulting to land facing them atop the old stone foundation. More than that, three balls, red, white, and black, began dancing between his hands even as he landed. A soft sound came from the watchers, half astonishment, half satisfaction. Even Rand forgot his irritation. He flashed Egwene a grin and got a delighted one in return. Then both turned to stare unabashedly at the gleeman.
"You want stories?" Tom Merlin declaimed. "I have stories, and I'll give them to you. I'll make them come alive before your eyes."
A blue ball joined the others from somewhere, then a green one and a yellow.
"Tales of great wars and great heroes for the men and boys. For the women and girls, the entire Aptarogyne cycle. Tales of Arthur Pendrag, Tanriol, Arthur Hawkwing, Arthur the High King, who once ruled all the lands from the Aiel Waste to the Arith Ocean, and even beyond. Wondrous stories of strange people and strange lands, of the Green Man, of warders and Trollocs,
of Ogier and Aiel, the Thousand Tales of Anla, the Wise Counselor, Jaime, the Giant Slayer, how Susa tamed Jain Farstrider, Mara and the Three Foolish Kings.
"Tell us about Len," Egwene called, "how he flew to the moon in the belly of an eagle made of fire. Tell about his daughter, Salia, walking among the stars."
Rand looked at her out of the corner of his eye, but she seemed intent on the Gleeman. She had never liked stories about adventures and long journeys. Her favorites were always the funny ones, or stories about women outwitting people who were supposed to be smarter than everyone else. He was sure she had asked for tales about Len and Salia to put a burr under his shirt. Surely she could see the world outside was no place for Two Rivers folk. Listening to tales of adventures, even dreaming about them, was one thing. Having them take place around you would be something else again.
"Old stories, those," Tom Marilyn said, and abruptly he was juggling three colored balls with each hand. "Stories from the age before the Age of Legends, some say. Perhaps even older. But I have old stories, mind you now, of ages that were and will be. Ages when men ruled the heavens and the stars, and ages when man roamed as brother to the animals. Ages of wonder and ages of horror. Ages ended by fire raining from the skies, and ages doomed by snow and ice covering land and sea. I have old stories, and I will tell old stories. Tales of Musk the Giant with his lance of fire that could reach around the world, and his wars with Alsbet, the Queen of All. Tales of Mutaris, the Healer, Mother of the Wondrous Ind."
The balls now danced between Tom's hands in two intertwining circles. His voice was almost a chant, and he turned slowly as he spoke, as if surveying the onlookers to gauge his effect.
"I will tell you of the end of the Age of Legends, of the dragon, and his attempt to free the Dark One into the world of men. I will tell of the time of madness, when Aes Sedai shattered the world, of the Trolloc Wars, when men battled Trollocs for rule of the earth, of the War of the Hundred Years, when men battled men, and the nations of our day were wrought. I will tell the adventures of men and women, rich and poor, great and small, proud and humble. The siege of the Pillars of the Sky. How goodwife Carol cured her husband of snoring. How Dareth and the fall of the House of..."
Abruptly the flow of words and the juggling alike stopped. Tom simply snatched the balls from the air and stopped talking. Unnoticed by Rand, Moraine had joined the listeners. Lan was at her shoulder, though he had to look twice to see the man. For a moment, Tom looked at Moraine sideways, his face and body still except for making the balls disappear into his capacious coat sleeves. Then he bowed to her, holding his cloak wide.
"Your pardon, but you are surely not from this district?"
"Lady," Ewan hissed fiercely, "the Lady Moraine."
Tom blinked, then bowed again, more deeply.
"Your pardon again, lady. I meant no disrespect."
Moraine made a small waving-away gesture.
"None was perceived, Master Bard, and my name is simply Moraine. I am indeed a stranger here, a traveler like yourself, far from home and alone. The world can be a dangerous place when one is a stranger."
"The Lady Moraine collects stories," Ewan put in. "Stories about things that happened in the Two Rivers. Though I don't know whatever happened here to make a story of."
"I trust you will like my stories as well, Moraine."
Tom watched her with obvious wariness. He looked not best pleased to find her there. Suddenly Rand wondered what sort of entertainment a lady like her might be offered in a city like Berlan or Camelin. Surely it could not be anything better than a Gleeman.
"That is a matter of taste, Master Bard," Moraine replied. "Some stories I like, and some I do not."
Tom's bow was his deepest yet, bending his long body parallel to the ground.
"I assure you, none of my stories will displease. All will please and entertain, and you do me too much honor. I am a simple gleeman, that and nothing more."
Moraine answered his bow with a gracious nod. For an instant she seemed even more the Lady Ewen had named her,
accepting an offering from one of her subjects. Then she turned away, and Lan followed, a wolf healing a gliding swan. Tom stared after them, bushy brows drawn down, stroking his long mustaches with a knuckle, until they were halfway up the green.
"He's not pleased at all," Rand thought.
"Are you going to juggle some more now?" Ewen demanded.
"Eat fire!" Matt shouted. "I want to see you eat fire!"
"The harp!"
a voice cried from the crowd.
"Play the harp!"
Someone else called for the flute. At that moment, the door of the inn opened, and the village council trundled out, Nynaeve in their midst. Padan Fane was not with them, Rand saw. Apparently the peddler had decided to remain in the warm common room with his mulled wine. Muttering about
a strong brandy,
Tom Marilyn abruptly jumped down from the old foundation. He ignored the cries of those who had been watching him, pressing inside past the councillors before they were well out of the doorway.
"Is he supposed to be a gleeman or a king?"
Senbui asked in annoyed tones.
"A waste of good money, if you ask me."
Bran Alvir half turned after the gleeman, then shook his head.
"That man may be more trouble than he's worth."
Nynaeve, busy gathering her cloak around her, sniffed loudly.
"Worry about the gleeman if you want, Brandelwyn Alvir. At least he is in Emmon's field, which is more than you can say for this false dragon. But as long as you are worrying, there are others here who should excite your worry."
"If you please, Wisdom," Bran said stiffly, "kindly leave who should worry me to my deciding. Mistress Moraine and Master Lan are guests in my inn, and decent, respectable folk, so I say. Neither of them has called me a fool in front of the whole council. Neither of them has told the council it hasn't a full set of wits among them."
"It seems my estimate was too high by half," Nynaeve retorted.
She strode away without a backward glance, leaving Bran's jaw working as he searched for a reply. Egwene looked at Rand as if she were going to speak, then darted after the Wisdom instead. Rand knew there must be some way to stop her from leaving the Two Rivers, but the only way he could think of was not one he was prepared to take, even if she was willing. And she had as much said she was not willing at all, which made him feel even worse.
"That young woman wants a husband," Senbui growled, bouncing on his toes.
His face was purple and getting darker.
"She lacks proper respect. We're the village council, not boys raking her yard, and..."
The mayor breathed heavily through his nose and suddenly rounded on the old thatcher.
"Be quiet, Sen. Stop acting like a black-veiled Aiel."
The skinny man froze in his toes in astonishment. The mayor never let his temper get the best of him. Bran glared.
"Burn me, but we have better things to be about than this foolishness. Or do you intend to prove Nynaeve right?"
With that, he stumped back into the inn and slammed the door behind him. The council members glanced at Sen, then moved off in their separate directions. All but Harald Luhan, who accompanied the stony-visaged thatcher, talking quietly. The blacksmith was the only one who could ever get Sen to see reason. Rand went to meet his father, and his friends trailed after him.
"I've never seen Master Alvir so mad," was the first thing Rand said, getting him a disgusted look from Matt.
"A mayor and the Wisdom seldom agree," Tam said, "and they agree less than usual today, that's all. It's the same in every village."
"What about the false dragon?"
Matt asked, and Perrin added eager murmurs.
"What about the Aes Sedai?"
Tam shook his head slowly.
"Master Fane knew little more than he had already told, at least little of interest to us. Battles won or lost, cities taken and retaken. All in Giladan, thank the light. It hasn't spread, or had not the last Master Fane knew."
"Battles interest me," Matt said, and Perrin added, "What did he say about them?"
"Battles don't interest me, Matrim," Tam said. "But I'm sure he will be glad to tell you all about them later. What does interest me is that we shouldn't have to worry about them here, as far as the council can tell. We can see no reason for Aes Sedai to come here on their way south. And as for the return journey, they aren't likely to want to cross the Forest of Shadows and swim the White River."
Rand and the others chuckled at the idea. There were three reasons why no one came into the Two Rivers except from the north, by the way of Tarin Ferry. The Mountains of Mist in the west were the first, of course, and the Mire blocked the east just as effectively.
To the south was the White River, which got its name from the way rocks and boulders churned its swift waters to froth. And beyond the White lay the Forest of Shadows. Few Two Rivers folk had ever crossed the White, and fewer still returned if they did. It was generally agreed, though, that the Forest of Shadows stretched south for 100 miles or more, without a road or a village, but with plenty of wolves and bears.
"So that's an end to it for us," Matt said.
He sounded at least a little disappointed.
"Not quite," Tam said. "Day after tomorrow we will send men to Devon Ride and Watch Hill and Tarn Ferry, too, to arrange for a watch to be kept. Riders along the White and the Tarn both, and patrols between. It should be done today, but only the mayor agrees with me. The rest can't see asking anyone to spend Beltane off riding across the two rivers."
"But I thought you said we didn't have to worry," Perrin said, and Tam shook his head.
"I said should not, boy, not did not. I've seen men die because they were sure that what should not happen would not. Besides, the fighting will stir up all sorts of people. Most will just be trying to find safety, but others will be looking for a way to profit from the confusion. We'll offer any of the first a helping hand, but we must be ready to send the second type on their way."
Abruptly, Matt spoke up.
"Can we be part of it? I want to, anyway. You know I can ride as well as anyone in the village."
"You want a few weeks of cold, boredom, and sleeping rough?" Tam chuckled. "Likely that's all there will be to it." "I hope that's all. Well, we're out of the way, even for refugees. But you can speak to Master Alvir if your mind is made up. Rand, it's time for us to be getting back to the farm."
Rand blinked in surprise.
"I thought we were staying for winter night."
"Things need seeing to at the farm, and I need you with me."
"Even so, we don't have to leave for hours yet, and I want to volunteer for the patrols, too."
"We are going now," his father replied in a tone that brooked no argument. In a softer voice, he added, "We'll be back tomorrow, and plenty of time for you to speak to the mayor. And plenty of time for festival, too. 5 minutes now, then meet me in the stable."
"Are you going to join Rand and me on the watch?" Matt asked Perrin as Tam left. "I'll bet there's nothing like this ever happened in the Two Rivers before. Why, if we get up to the Tarn, we might even see soldiers, or who knows what. Even tinkers."
"I expect I will," Perrin said slowly. "If Master Luhan doesn't need me, that is."
"The war is in Giladon," Rand snapped.
With an effort, he lowered his voice.
"The war is in Giladon. And the Aes Sedai are the light knows where, but none of it is here. The man in the black cloak is, or have you forgotten him already?"
The others exchanged embarrassed looks.
"Sorry, Rand," Matt muttered, "but a chance to do something besides milk my da's cows doesn't come along very often."
He straightened under their startled stares.
"Well, I do milk them, and every day, too."
"The Black Rider," Rand reminded them. "What if he hurts somebody?"
"Maybe he's a refugee from the war," Perrin said doubtfully.
"Whatever he is," Matt said, "the watch will find him."
"Maybe," Rand said, "but he seems to disappear when he wants to. It might be better if they knew to look for him."
"We'll tell Master Alvir when we volunteer for the patrols," Matt said, "and he'll tell the council, and they'll tell the watch."
"The council?" Perrin said incredulously. "We'd be lucky if the mayor didn't laugh out loud. Master Luhan and Rand's father already think the two of us are jumping at shadows."
Rand sighed.
"If we're going to do it, we might as well do it now. He won't laugh any louder today than he will tomorrow."
"Maybe," Perrin said with a sidelong glance at Matt, "we should try finding some others who've seen him. We'll see just about everybody in the village tonight."
Matt's scowl deepened, but he still did not say anything. All of them understood that Perrin meant they should find witnesses who were more reliable than Matt.
"He won't laugh any louder tomorrow," Perrin added when Rand hesitated. "And I'd just as soon have somebody else with us when we go to him. Half the village would suit me fine."
Rand nodded slowly. He could already hear Master Alvir laughing. More witnesses certainly could not hurt. And if three of them had seen the fellow, others had to have too.
"They must have.
Tomorrow, then. You two find whoever you can tonight, and tomorrow we go to the mayor.
After that?
They looked at him silently, no one raising the question of what happened if they could not find anyone else who had seen the black-cloaked man. The question was clear in their eyes, though, and he had no answer. He sighed heavily.
I'd better go now. My father will be wondering if I fell into a hole.
Followed by their goodbyes, he trotted around to the stable yard where the high-wheeled cart stood propped on its shafts. The stable was a long, narrow building topped by a high-peaked, thatched roof. Stalls, their floors covered with straw, filled both sides of the dim interior, lit only by the open double doors at either end. The peddler's team munched their oats in the 8 stalls, and Master Alvear's massive Durans, the team he hired out when farmers had hauling beyond the abilities of their own horses, filled 6 more. But only 3 others were occupied. Rand thought he could match up horse and rider with no trouble. The tall, deep-chested black stallion that swung up his head fiercely had to be Lan's. The sleek white mare with an arched neck, her quick steps as graceful as a girl dancing, even in the stall, could only belong to Moraine. And the third unfamiliar horse, a rangy, slab-sided gelding of a dusty brown, fit Tom Maryland perfectly. Tam stood in the rear of the stable, holding Bella by a lead rope, and speaking quietly to Hugh and Tad. Before Rand had taken 2 steps into the stable, his father nodded to the stableman and brought Bella out, wordlessly gathering up Rand as he went. They harnessed the shaggy mare in silence. Tam appeared so deep in thought that Rand held his tongue. He did not really look forward to trying to convince his father about the black-cloaked rider, much less the mare. Tomorrow would have to be time enough, when Matt and the rest had found others who had seen the man. If they found others. As the cart lurched into motion, Rand took his bow and quiver from the back, awkwardly belting the quiver at his waist as he half-trotted alongside. When they reached the last row of houses in the village, he knocked an arrow, carrying it half-raised and partly drawn. There was nothing to see except mostly leafless trees, but his shoulders tightened. The black rider could be on them before either of them knew it. There might not be time to draw the bow if he was not already halfway to it. He knew he could not keep up the tension on the bowstring for long. He had made the bow himself, and Tam was one of the few others in the district who could even draw it all the way to the cheek. He cast around for something to take his mind off thinking about the dark rider. Surrounded by the forest, their cloaks flapping in the wind, it was not easy.
"Father," he said finally, "I don't understand why the council had to question Padan Fane."
With an effort, he took his eyes off the woods and looked across Bella at Tam.
"It seems to me the decision you reached could have been made right on the spot. The mayor frightened everybody half out of their wits, talking about Aes Sedai and the false dragon here in the Two Rivers."
"People are funny, Rand. The best of them are. Take Harald Luhan. Master Luhan is a strong man and a brave one, but he can't bear to see butchering done. Turns pale as a sheet."
"What does that have to do with anything? Everybody knows Master Luhan can't stand the sight of blood, and nobody but the Coplins and the Congers thinks anything of it."
"Just this, lad. People don't always think or behave the way you might believe they would. Those folk back there, let the hail beat their crops into the mud and the wind take off every roof in the district, and the wolves kill half their livestock, and they'll roll up their sleeves and start from scratch. They'll grumble, but they won't waste any time with it. But you give them just the thought of Aes Sedai and a false dragon in Gil-Dan, and soon enough they'll start thinking that Gil-Dan is not that far the other side of the Forest of Shadows, and a straight line from Tar-Valon to Gil-Dan wouldn't pass that much to the east of us. As if the Aes Sedai wouldn't take the road through Camelin and Lugard instead of traveling cross-country. By tomorrow morning, half the village would have been sure the entire war was about to descend on us. It would take weeks to undo. A fine beltine that would make. So Bran gave them the idea before they could get it for themselves. They've seen the council take the problem under consideration, and by now they'll be hearing what we decided. They chose us for the village council because they trust we can reason things out in the best way for everybody. They trust our opinions. Even Sen's, which doesn't say much for the rest of us, I suppose. At any rate, they will hear there isn't anything to worry about, and they'll believe it. It is not that they couldn't reach the same conclusion, or would not, eventually.
But this way we won't have festival ruined, and nobody has to spend weeks worrying about something that isn't likely to happen. If it does, against all odds, well, the patrols will give us enough warning to do what we can. I truly don't think it will come to that, though. Rand puffed out his cheeks. Apparently being on the council was far more complicated than he had believed. The cart rumbled on along the quarry road. "Did anyone besides Perrin see this strange rider?" Tam asked.
"Matt did, but..."
Rand blinked, then stared across Bella's back at his father.
"You believe me? I have to go back. I have to tell them."
Tam's shout halted him as he turned to run back to the village.
"Hold, lad, hold. Do you think I waited this long to speak for no reason?"
Reluctantly, Rand kept on beside the cart, still creaking along behind patient Bella.
"What made you change your mind? Why can't I tell the others?"
"They'll know soon enough. At least Perrin will. Matt, I'm not sure of. Word must be gotten to the farms as best it can. But in another hour, there won't be anyone in Emmonsfield above 16, those who can be responsible about it at least, who doesn't know a stranger is skulking around, and likely not the sort you would invite to festival. The winter has been bad enough without this to scare the young ones."
"Festival," Rand said. "If you had seen him, you wouldn't want him closer than 10 miles. 100, maybe."
"Perhaps so," Tam said placidly. "He could be just a refugee from the troubles in Giladon, or more likely a thief who thinks the pickings will be easier here than in Beirlon or Tarin Ferry. Even so, no one around here has so much they can afford to have it stolen. If the man is trying to escape the war, well, that's still no excuse for scaring people. Once the watch is mounted, it should either find him or frighten him off."
"I hope it frightens him off. But why do you believe me now, when you didn't this morning?"
"I had to believe my own eyes then, lad, and I saw nothing." Tam shook his grizzled head. "Only young men see this fellow, it seems. When Harald Luhan mentioned Perrin jumping shadows, though, it all came out. John Thane's oldest son saw him, too, and so did Samuel Craw's boy, Bandry. Well, when four of you say you've seen a thing, and solid lads all, we start thinking maybe it's there, whether we can see it or not. All except Sen, of course. Anyway, that's why we're going home. With both of us away, this stranger could be up to any kind of mischief there. If not for festival, I wouldn't come back tomorrow, either. But we can't make ourselves prisoners in our own homes just because this fellow is lurking about."
"I didn't know about Banner Lem," Rand said. "The rest of us were going to the mayor tomorrow. But we were worried he wouldn't believe us either."
"Gray hairs don't mean our brains have curdled," Tam said dryly. "So you keep a sharp eye. Maybe I'll catch sight of him, too, if he shows up again." Rand settled down to do just that. He was surprised to realize that his step felt lighter. The knots were gone from his shoulders. He was still scared, but it was not so bad as it had been. Tam and he were just as alone on the quarry road as they had been that morning, but in some way he felt as if the entire village were with them. That others knew and believed made all the difference. There was nothing the black-cloaked horseman could do that the people of Emmonsfield could not handle together. Chapter 5 Winter Night. The sun stood halfway down from its noonday high by the time the cart reached the farmhouse. It was not a big house, not nearly so large as some of the sprawling farmhouses to the east, dwellings that had grown over the years to hold entire families. In the Two Rivers, that often included 3 or 4 generations under one roof, including aunts, uncles, cousins, and nephews. Tam and Rand were considered out of the ordinary as much for being two men living alone as for farming in the Westwood. Here most of the rooms were on one floor, a neat rectangle with no wings or additions. 2 bedrooms and an attic storeroom fitted up under the steeply sloped thatch. If the whitewash was all but gone from the stout wooden walls after the winter storms, the house was still in a tidy state of repair, the thatch tightly mended, and the doors and shutters well hung and snug-fitting. House, barn, and stone sheep pen formed the points of a triangle around the farmyard, where a few chickens had ventured out to scratch at the cold ground.
An open shearing shed and a stone dipping trough stood next to the sheep pen. Hard by the fields, between the farmyard and the trees, loomed the tall cone of a tight-walled curing shed. Few farmers in the Two Rivers could make do without both wool and tobacco to sell when the merchants came. When Rand took a look in the stone pen, the heavy-horned herd ram looked back at him, but most of the black-faced flock remained placidly where they lay, or stood, with their heads in the feed trough. Their coats were thick and curly, but it was still too cold for shearing. "I don't think the black-cloaked man came here," Rand called to his father, who was walking slowly around the farmhouse, spear held at the ready, examining the ground intently. "The sheep wouldn't be so settled if that one had been around." Tam nodded, but did not stop. When he had made a complete circuit of the house, he did the same around the barn and the sheep pen, still studying the ground. He even checked the smokehouse and the curing shed. Drawing a bucket of water from the well, he flipped a cupped hand, sniffed the water, and gingerly touched it with the tip of his tongue. Abruptly, he barked a laugh, then drank it down in a quick gulp. "I suppose he didn't," he told Rand, wiping his hand on his coat front. "All this about men and horses I can't see or hear just makes me look crossways at everything." He emptied the well water into another bucket and started for the house, the bucket in one hand and his spear in the other. "I'll start some stew for supper. And as long as we're here, we might as well get caught up on a few chores." Rand grimaced, regretting winter night in Emmons Field. But Tam was right. Around a farm, the work never really got done. As soon as one thing was finished, two more always needed doing. He hesitated about it, but kept his bow and quiver close at hand. If the Dark Rider did appear, he had no intention of facing him with nothing but a hoe. First was stabling Bella. Once he had unharnessed her and put her into a stall in the barn next to their cow, he set his cloak aside and rubbed the mare down with handfuls of dry straw, then curried her with a pair of brushes. Climbing the narrow ladder to the loft, he pitched down hay for her feed. He fetched a scoopful of oats for her as well, though there was little enough left, and might be no more for a long while, unless the weather warmed soon. The cow had been milked that morning before first light, giving a quarter of her usual yield. She seemed to be drying up as the winter hung on. Enough feed had been left to see the sheep for 2 days. They should have been in the pasture by now, but there was none worth calling it so. Buddy topped off their water. Whatever eggs had been laid needed to be gathered, too. There were only 3. The hens seemed to be getting cleverer at hiding them. He was taking a hoe to the vegetable garden behind the house when Tam came out and settled on a bench in front of the barn to mend harness, propping his spear beside him. It made Rand feel better about the bow lying on his cloak a pace from where he stood. Few weeds had pushed above ground, but more weeds than anything else. The cabbages were stunted, barely a sprout of the beans or peas showed, and there was not a sign of a beet. Not everything had been planted, of course, only part, in hopes the cold might break in time to make a crop of some kind before the cellar was empty. It did not take long to finish hoeing, which would have suited him just fine in years past, but now he wondered what they would do if nothing came up this year. Not a pleasant thought. And there was still firewood to split. It seemed to Rand like years since there had not been firewood to split. But complaining would not keep the house warm, so he fetched the axe, propped up bow and quiver beside the chopping block, and got to work. Pine for a quick hot flame, and oak for long burning. Before long, he was warm enough to put his coat aside. When the pile of split wood grew big enough, he stacked it against the side of the house, beside other stacks already there. Most reached all the way to the eaves. Usually by this time of year the wood piles were small and few, but not this year. Chop and stack, chop and stack. He lost himself in the rhythm of the axe and the motions of stacking wood. Tam's hand on his shoulder brought him back to where he was, and for a moment he blinked in surprise. Great twilight had come on while he worked, and already it was fading quickly toward night. The full moon stood well above the treetops, shimmering pale and bulging as if about to fall on their heads. The wind had grown colder without his noticing, too, and tattered clouds scudded across the darkling sky. "Let's wash up, lad, and see about some supper. I've already carried in water for hot baths before sleep." "Anything hot sounds good to me," Rand said, snatching up his cloak and tossing it round his shoulders.
Sweat soaked his shirt, and the wind, forgotten in the heat of swinging the axe, seemed to be trying to freeze it, now that he had stopped work. He stifled a yawn, shivering as he gathered the rest of his things.
And sleep, too, for that. I might just sleep right through festival.
Would you care to make a small wager about that? Tam smiled, and Rand had to grin back. He would not miss Beltane if he had had no sleep in a week. No one would. Tam had been extravagant with the candles, and a fire crackled in the big stone fireplace, so that the main room had a warm, cheerful feel to it. A broad oaken table was the main feature of the room, other than the fireplace, a table long enough to seat a dozen or more, though there had seldom been so many around it since Rand's mother died. A few cabinets and chests, most of them skillfully made by Tam himself, lined the walls, and high-backed chairs stood around the table. The cushioned chair that Tam called his reading chair sat angled before the flames. Rand preferred to do his reading, stretched out on the rug in front of the fire. The shelf of books by the door was not nearly as long as the one at the Wine Spring Inn, but books were hard to come by. Few peddlers carried more than a handful, and those had to be stretched out among everyone who wanted them. If the room did not look quite so freshly scrubbed as most farm wives kept their homes, Tam's pipe rack and the travels of Giant Farstrider sat on the table, while another wood-bound book rested on the cushion of his reading chair. A bit of harness to be mended lay on the bench by the fireplace, and some shirts to be darned made a heap on a chair. If not quite so spotless, it was still clean and neat enough, with a lived-in look that was almost as warming and comforting as the fire. Here, it was possible to forget the chill beyond the walls. There was no false dragon here, no wars, no Aes Sedai. No men in black cloaks. The aroma from the stew pot hanging over the fire permeated the room and filled Rand with ravenous hunger. His father stirred the stew pot with a long-handled wooden spoon, then took a taste. A little while longer. Rand hurried to wash his face and hands. There was a pitcher and basin on the washstand by the door. A hot bath was what he wanted to take away the sweat and soak the chill out, but that would come when there had been time to heat the big kettle in the back room. Tam rooted around in a cabinet and came up with the key as long as his hand. He twisted it in the big iron lock on the door. At Rand's questioning look, he said, "Best to be safe. Maybe I'm taking a fancy, or maybe the weather is blacking my mood. But," he sighed and bounced the key on his palm. "I'll see to the back door," he said, and disappeared toward the back of the house. Rand could not remember either door ever being locked. No one in the Two Rivers locked doors. There was no need. Until now, at least. From overhead, from Tam's bedroom, came a scraping as of something being dragged across the floor. Rand frowned. Unless Tam had suddenly decided to move the furniture around, he could only be pulling out the old chest he kept under his bed. Another thing that had never been done in Rand's memory. He filled a small kettle with water for tea and hung it from a hook over the fire, then set the table. He had carved the bowls and spoons himself. The front shutters had not yet been closed, and from time to time he peered out. But full night had come, and all he could see were moon shadows. The Dark Rider could be out there easily enough, but he tried not to think about that. When Tam came back, Rand stared in surprise. A thick belt slanted around Tam's waist, and from the belt hung a sword with a bronze heron on the black scabbard and another on the long hilt. The only men Rand had ever seen wearing swords were the merchant's guards, and Lan, of course. That his father might own one had never even occurred to him. Except for the herons, the sword looked a good deal like Lan's sword. "Where did that come from?" he asked. "Did you get it from a peddler? How much did it cost?" Slowly, Tam drew the weapon. Firelight played along the gleaming length. It was nothing at all like the plain, rough blades Rand had seen in the hands of merchant's guards. No gems or gold adorned it, but it seemed grand to him nonetheless. The blade, very slightly curved and sharp on only one edge, bore another heron etched into the steel. Short quillons, worked to look like braid, flanked the hilt. It seemed almost fragile compared with the swords of the merchant's guards. Most of those were double-edged and thick enough to chop down a tree. "I got it a long time ago," Tam said, "a long way from here. And I paid entirely too much."
Two coppers is too much for one of these. Your mother didn't approve, but she was always wiser than I. I was younger then, and it seemed worth the price at the time. She always wanted me to get rid of it, and more than once I thought she was right, that I should just give it away. Reflected fire made the blade seem aflame. Rand started. He had often daydreamed about owning a sword.
Give it away? How could you give a sword like that away?
Tam snorted. Not much use in herding sheep now, is it? Can't plow a field or harvest a crop with it. For a long minute, he stared at the sword as if wondering what he was doing with such a thing. At last, he let out a heavy sigh. But if I am not just taken by a black fancy, if our luck runs sour, maybe in the next few days we'll be glad I tucked it in that old chest instead. He slid the sword smoothly back into its sheath and wiped his hand on his shirt with a grimace. The stew should be ready. I'll dish it out while you fix the tea. Rand nodded and got the tea canister. But he wanted to know everything. Why would Tam have bought a sword? He could not imagine. And where had Tam come by it? How far away? No one ever left the Two Rivers, or very few at least. He had always vaguely supposed his father must have gone outside. His mother had been an outlander. But a sword? He had a lot of questions to ask once they had settled at the table. The tea water was boiling fiercely, and he had to wrap a cloth around the kettle's handle to lift it off the hook. Heat soaked through immediately. As he straightened from the fire, a heavy thump at the door rattled the lock. All thoughts of the sword, or the hot kettle in his hand, flew away.
One of the neighbors, he said uncertainly. Master Daughtry wanting to borrow.
But the Daughtry farm, their nearest neighbor, was an hour away, even in the daylight. And Orrin Daughtry, shameless borrower that he was still not likely to leave his house by dark. Tam softly placed the stew-filled bowls on the table. Slowly he moved away from the table. Both of his hands rested on his sword hilt. I don't think, he began, and the door burst open, pieces of the iron lock spinning across the floor. A figure filled the doorway, bigger than any man Rand had ever seen. A figure in black mail that hung to his knees, with spikes at wrists and elbows and shoulders. One hand clutched a heavy, scythe-like sword. The other hand was flung up before his eyes as if to shield them from the light. Rand felt the beginnings of an odd sort of